Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Choose my friends when I'm in France.
Here's a story from France that will sound sadly familiar. Recently, a young black man named Adama Traoré died during a police interrogation in a suburb outside Paris. His death has launched protests, including some nights of street violence that spread to several other areas. France's history of police-related deaths has contributed to the anger over Traoré's death. And activists there are drawing on our Black Lives Matter movement to communicate their frustration. Emma Jacobs has our story.
Adama Traoré's family members have repeatedly challenged the official explanations of his death. Authorities first said the 24-year-old died from a heart attack, but later that he had a severe infection.
Mon frère a été tué. Il est mort, mon frère.
My brother was killed, said Assa Traoré last week. She spoke just before a march of about 2,000 people through their Paris suburb, saying her brother died on his birthday.
Il est mort dans des conditions atroces, seul.
He died in atrocious conditions, alone, without us. On his birthday, she said. I was overseas. I couldn't even give him a hug to wish him a happy birthday. Traoré lived in a lower-income neighborhood outside the quaint core of Beaumont-sur-Oise. Caroline Vivier, who came out to show her support, says tension between young people and the police is not new here.
Et la police, il y a toujours eu un espèce de rapport de force.
There's always been a relationship of force. And today it's being felt even more. We're also thinking of what's happening in the U.S. Unfortunately, we're connecting these incidents.
The next day, there is a scene elsewhere in France that could just as easily have taken place in the U.S. A crowd of protesters chanting Black Lives Matter come face to face with lines of riot police. But this is central Paris, at an event that had actually been planned weeks before Adama Traoré's death. It was supposed to be a march of solidarity, ending at the U.S. Embassy. But now there's a greater sense of urgency for people here, like Fatih Cissé.
This happened close to home. We were already affected by the events in the U.S., and now this touches us even more.
Paris authorities revoked permission for the planned march, so the crowd of a few hundred people march around the plaza from blocked entrance to blocked entrance. The protesters also chant in French, "Justice for Adama." One of them is Fanny Essier, who describes herself as an Afrofeminist.
In the U.S., it's true, there are guns, so the violence there is more direct, more brutal, more spectacular. But there's also police violence in French neighborhoods.
She ticks off a number of names of other young men of color, including two who died during a police pursuit that sparked rolling riots in 2005. That violence shook the country, and it's what many people think of when they see images of cars burning in Beaumont-sur-Oise. Essier, like Adama Traoré, is 24, and she also has a brother, who she says is regularly stopped by police.
He was stopped once by police seven times in a day, even though he doesn't smoke. He doesn't drink, etc. And I have white friends who drink and smoke, who smoke illegal substances, and they're never stopped. And I say, well, that's bizarre.
She says the Black Lives Matter movement in the U.S. didn't kick off this conversation in France about police violence, but it's energized it. Plus, the slogan, Black Lives Matter, draws a connection to racism in the U.S.
The French media are always interested in questions of racism in the U.S. They don't have any trouble identifying it and condemning it. But when it comes to France, no.
But making comparisons between race relations here in the U.S. can be sensitive. On one side of the square, a heated argument takes place between a man eating at a cafe and a group of young protesters. You are creating divisions. You are creating racism, he tells them, and repeats, this is not the United States. This is not an unusual attitude in France. There's a lot of criticism here of American-style identity politics. In contrast, France is supposed to be strictly egalitarian and theoretically colorblind, so there's an emphasis on downplaying differences. But many of these young Black activists believe this makes it difficult to deal with racial problems that do exist in France. A law student named Theodore Jean-Baptiste explains.
Today, we realize that the lives of Black people aren't treated the same way by the police and justice system as the life of someone from another community. While France doesn't officially recognize differences, we see a failure there because there is a difference in treatment.
He'll keep pushing for more media attention to Adama Traoré's death, he says, until justice is done. The next step in Traoré's case will be a new autopsy requested by the family. For The World, Emma Jacobs, Paris.
Decades ago, I said that, you know, I didn't know much about Brazil, still don't. But from what I heard from people who had been there, or people who were from there, because I'd heard a long time ago that outside of Africa, the largest population of Black people is in Brazil.
Brazil remains the country most affected by the Zika virus, with at least 1,600 cases of the birth defect microcephaly. The country is also one of the most dangerous places in the world to be female. Numbers show that a woman in Brazil is killed every 2 hours and assaulted every 15 seconds, often by someone she knows. NPR's Lulu Garcia Navarro traveled to the northern Brazilian city of Natal, where gender violence has skyrocketed. She begins her story with the case of a woman who was murdered. And a warning to our listeners, this story does contain graphic details, which might not be appropriate for everyone.
She thought she was safe. Alexandra Moreira thought she had managed to break away and protect herself. On the day she was killed, her brother even escorted her to the station in the morning.
When she got on the bus, my brother told her, if anything happens, just call me. 10 minutes later, his phone rang, and it was her. All he could hear was her screaming, pleading for help.
That's Andresa da Silva, the sister of 32-year-old Alexandra. The bus had just been pulling away when the father of Alexandra's four children jumped on.
He went straight to where she was. He wanted her to get off, but she refused. They started fighting, and she said she wouldn't go with him. That's when he pulled out his knife. He stabbed her 21 times.
Andresa da Silva shows me a picture of her sister. In it, she's sitting on a bed. Her long, dark hair frames her smiling face. Alexandra, she says, had been with the man who ended up murdering her for 18 years. But Andresa says her family didn't know Alexandra's secret life.
Sometimes we'd see her with a bruise or a mark, and she'd tell us that one of the kids had bitten her or some other excuse. She never told us. It was only when she finally left him that she confessed that he beat her and her children.
Beat her savagely, cutting her, tying her up.
He would tell her that if she ever said what was going on, he would kill her, the children, and our parents.
But one day, she'd had enough. He had attacked her at the supermarket where she worked, bashing her head. She reported him to the police, and she was taken into a woman's shelter for victims of domestic violence called a casa abrigo in Brazil. Except he found out where it was. He showed up. The shelter asked for a restraining order against him, but the court didn't grant one. So Alexandra was actually asked to leave. and she went to go stay with her parents. He became relentless, Andresa tells me. He would show up outside the house at all hours of the day and night. The police did nothing. The neighbors said nothing. And then, on that December morning, he finally made good on his threats. Why do you think this happened? I ask Andresa. The men here think that if you're with a woman, you own her, she tells me. Latin America has the highest rate of murders of women on earth. In most countries of the region, including Brazil, there are specific laws against femicide and violence against women generally. But they haven't been working. Ana Claudia Mengis is the director of Natal's Violence Against Women Department. She says the reasons for the uptick in violence are many. Murders generally are up in northern Brazil as drug and gang violence takes its toll amid a security crisis. Also, new laws haven't acted as deterrents, with police and the courts failing to follow through. Add to that a lack of budget and facilities. In Natal, there's only one women's shelter. We are allowed to meet some of the women who are sheltered in the same Casa Abrigo Natal, where Alexandra had been staying. We agreed not to use their names for their protection. The first woman is 26. She tells me she met the man she's now hiding from when she was only 15. She had a child with him when she was just 17. He would rape her. Hurt her. She told people what was happening, but even her family said it was better to have a man, even a bad one, than not. For another woman at the shelter, the root of this crisis of violence against women starts in the home. She says, you see people tell their sons that they shouldn't do a specific activity because it's women's work. She says, boys are allowed to run and play while girls are taught to cook and clean. It teaches us to be submissive, she says, to be subjugated. Our last stop was to see the prosecutor, Erika Veras, who was dealing with Alexandra, the murdered woman's case. She tells me she's still haunted by what happened.
Inclusive fui ao sepultamento dela.
I went to Alexandra's funeral, Erika Veras recounts, and the children were throwing themselves on the coffin. Don't go, mother, don't go, they screamed.
How did we lose that victim? Why did the system fail to protect her? For me, it was emblematic. Even with all the laws, even when everything was done to protect her by the book, we failed.
And then she shows me a diary entry that Alexandra wrote at the women's shelter when she finally thought she had broken free. It's entitled, The First Day of a New Life. Lulu Garcia Navarro, NPR News.
Okay, now three more women have come forward to accuse Bill Cosby of assaulting them, bringing the grand total to North America.
Now we want to spend a few minutes talking about a towering figure in American media. Roger Ailes created Fox News and ran it for 2 decades until he was forced to step down this week after allegations of sexual harassment became too big for Fox's owner Rupert Murdoch to ignore. We're turning now to biographer Gabriel Sherman to hear more about why Ailes is such an important figure and what his departure could mean, both to politics and television. He's the author of the unauthorized Ailes biography, The Loudest Voice in the Room, and a writer for New York Magazine. And he's with us now from Cleveland. Gabe Sherman, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, obviously, you wrote a whole book about this, but could you just give me the broad outlines of Roger Ailes' biography? How did he become such a pivotal figure?
Roger Ailes revolutionized American politics and media and became the most influential Republican in American life over the last 40 years by figuring out that television and politics were going to become one and the same thing. He got in on the ground floor of the Mike Douglas Show, a pioneering daytime TV show. And from those early days, he learned the techniques of show business and communication as an effective tool of political messaging. And in 1968, he was hired by Richard Nixon as a 27-year-old to be his chief television advisor. And he scripted and packaged Nixon, who had a famously dour and unappealing television image, and he reintroduced Richard Nixon to America as the new Nixon. And from that moment on, Republicans all over America flocked to him to craft and rebrand themselves. You know, it seems inevitable that Donald Trump has become the Republican nominee as a a reality television star because he is the conclusion of all of the work that Roger Ailes has done, injecting right-wing populism through moving images on television.
I do want to ask you in a minute about what Roger Ailes' relationship with Donald Trump has been. But before we get to that, so was it Ailes' intention to use the network as a tool for influencing Republican politics and specifically bringing conservatives to power?
Mm-hmm. Without question, as I document in my book, you know, Roger Ailes is a charismatic, towering figure. He runs Fox News, or he ran, I should say, as a cult of personality. And he believes deep in his heart, as he said to people many times, that he needs to save America, that Fox News was his megaphone to change and save America and preserve the republic. What Roger Ailes did when he created Fox News was to create a television news network that was anti-journalism. And so what he did with Fox News was to create it as a political campaign that would run against the American media, that would convince millions of Americans not to trust the mainstream, so-called mainstream media, and that Fox News would be the only place on television where you could find the truth. It was a brilliant marketing and political message that created a loyal core of viewers. And so the impact that it's had on American life over the last 20 years is almost impossible to overstate.
Why is Roger Ailes' departure coming now? There have been other incidents at Fox over the years. This didn't just happen overnight. So why now?
Principally, what's different now is that Rupert Murdoch's two adult children, James and Lachlan Murdoch, have been elevated into co-leadership positions atop the corporate parent that owns Fox News. And both Murdoch children have had their tangles with Roger Ailes in the past. Both children have been seeking a way to move him aside. And this lawsuit that Gretchen Carlson filed really gave them a powerful cudgel. And since then, Fox News women, including their biggest star, Megyn Kelly, have come forward to say that Roger Ailes made unwanted sexual advances towards them. So this gave the Murdoch children enough leverage with their father to say it's time for Roger Ailes to be removed from the company.
What is Roger Ailes' relationship with Donald Trump? I mean, you have argued that Donald Trump is, in fact, the culmination of what Roger Ailes has built.
I think it's a very close relationship. The two men have known each other for decades. They've traveled in similar circles. Roger Ailes really created Donald Trump as a political figure. While The Apprentice on NBC made him a celebrity, Roger Ailes gave him access to Fox News. He gave him a weekly segment to call into the morning show and spout off on politics. And he really got the ball rolling with Republican voters that Donald Trump could be a presidential candidate. In the wake of Gretchen Carlson's lawsuit, Donald Trump was advising Roger Ailes on how to navigate this sexual harassment scandal. And there is a lot of speculation here in Cleveland that with his exit from Fox News, Roger Ailes could, in fact, land as Donald Trump's media advisor and try to rekindle his role that started his political career in 1968 by helping Donald Trump get elected president.
And finally, how will this affect Republican politics? Since in your description, he has been such a key political player, both overtly and behind the scenes.
The future of Fox News is in many ways a metaphor for the future of the Republican Party. If Trump wins, the party will become rebranded as the Fox News Party. But if he loses, you know, the Republican Party is going through soul searching, and the same is going to happen for Fox News. Fox News is going through the same competition that the mainstream networks went through when Ailes launched the network. There are now multiple conservative media outlets on the right. There is Newsmax Television, which is a conservative media company run out of Florida that is now broadcasting into people's homes. Glenn Beck has started his own television and digital media company to compete with Fox. So we're seeing a fracturing of the conservative audience in the same way we saw a fracturing of the mainstream audience when there were just three broadcast networks way back when. And the Murdoch family is going to have to reassess, is this style of programming a profitable business strategy going forward? And my sense from talking to people inside the company that all bets are off, that they are looking far and wide at ways that they might reposition the channel as less overtly partisan and populist and try to relate to a different audience. And I think that's what we're going to see playing out in the months ahead.
Gabriel Sherman is a writer for New York Magazine and author of the unauthorized Roger Ailes biography, The Loudest Voice in the Room. We were able to catch him in Cleveland just before he packed up to move on to his next assignment. Gabe, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Medical apartheid. The dark history of medical experimentation on Black Americans from colonial times to the present. by Harriet A. Washington.
And now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. Should scientists have to ask for permission to study blood samples you gave at the doctor's office, or for a different study you already consented to years ago? Right now, they don't have to, but the Obama administration is proposing some new rules for how scientific research treats human subjects and these kinds of secondary uses of biospecimens. And under the proposed rules, researchers would have to get consent every time they reused your samples. What do scientists think? A report by the National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine is calling for the administration to scrap the proposal entirely and start over. Why would scientists be against more consent? Here with some insights is my guest, Holly Fernandez-Lynch, Executive Director of the Petrie Flom Center for Health Law Policy, Biotechnology, and Bioethics at Harvard Law School. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you for having me.
So what is it exactly is the rule change the government is proposing?
So just as you explained, when there are leftover specimens, leftover from blood drawn at the doctor's office or leftover from research that you participated in previously, as long as those specimens don't have any identifiers about you still attached to them, researchers are currently allowed to use them for whatever purposes they would like without going back to you to get your consent. And what's being proposed to be changed now is saying it doesn't matter if those specimens have been de-identified. We're still going to require researchers to get your consent before using them.
So what's
go ahead.
Go ahead. I just wanted to know, so what's the good and the bad about this?
So the good, what the government has said in proposing this rule change is, well, people don't know how their specimens are being used, and if we fail to tell them, we're going to lose trust in the research enterprise. And trust is really important for the Cancer Moonshot and the Precision Medicine Initiative, and so we really ought to be telling people what we're doing with their specimens. So that's sort of the justification that's been put forth. The bad is a couple of things, in my view. One, what the government is proposing to require is not specific informed consent every time your samples get used over again. Instead, what they're proposing is broad consent at the time the specimen is collected, so that you would say to the patient, okay, we've collected this specimen. Whenever there's something left over, we're going to give it to researchers and they can do what they want with it. Now, that's not really so protective of individual autonomy, right? Because you don't know, as the patient, exactly how your specimens are going to be used. And so it doesn't, for people who think consent is important, the broad consent that's been proposed doesn't go far enough. The other problem with it from the scientist's perspective is that requiring consent in this way can actually be quite damaging to biospecimen research going forward, because it's not that easy to collect consent and track it going forward. It's going to be quite expensive to do that. There'll be all sorts of logistical concerns for institutions and what for research institutions, and what may end up happening is that the institutions that are more poorly resourced are not going to ask consent. Instead, they're just going to say, forget it. We're not going to make those samples available for research. And that can end up biasing the samples that become available for research purposes going forward.
Is there a middle ground somewhere, something that you might suggest?
There is. So I actually sit on a government advisory panel. I'm not speaking on their behalf, but one of the things that we recommended was public education about how specimens are being used. It makes a lot of sense that people are confused. We're not telling them about this. And so, you know, we think that there's a responsibility for researchers and institutions to explain the value of biospecimen research, how low risk
right.
it is. And help people, you know, become aware of the social benefit of this research. That's one thing. Another step.
I've got
short
about
of
30 seconds, so
yeah.
we can get
yeah.
them in there.
Short of requiring actual consent would be an option to opt out of having your specimens be used if you're opposed to it. And then the last thing to do would be to punish people who are nefariously re-identifying specimens. That's something that's not currently part of the regulations or law, and it would be an important protection to add.
Thank you very much. Holly Fernandez-Lynch is at the Harvard Law School of Biotechnology and Bioethics.
happy headed.
A hot debate over hairstyles at Butler Traditional High School. WDRB's Rachel Collier explains why some call it discrimination.
The concern is that the dress code here at Butler High School unfairly targets African-American students.
What you do with your hair, to me, has nothing to do with your ability to learn as a student.
Former Metro Councilwoman and community activist Attica Scott is furious over the dress code policy her daughter, Ashanti Scott, received as an incoming sophomore at Butler Traditional High School.
I felt disrespected because it said clean and neat hair, and it made me feel like maybe they thought my hair wasn't clean.
It bans hairstyles often worn by African Americans, like dreadlocks, cornrows, and twists, afros longer than 2 inches, and braids on young men. Mohawks and unnatural colors are also prohibited. It's a policy made by Butler's site-based decision-making council. JCPS Superintendent Donna Hargan says the district will review it.
It's a policy that's been in place. It's not a new policy, and we appreciate that the concern has been brought to our attention because our Board of Education is adamant about, in its policies, about being inclusive.
Hargan says the policy may be revised.
The last thing that we need to be doing is saying to kids, you can't be you, you can't express your culture, you can't express your heritage. We want you to be like your white teachers and the white administration that we have at this school and your white classmates who have not had the same life experience as you.
Traditional high schools often have tighter dress codes, but Scott says that doesn't give room for discrimination.
Why would my response be to tuck tail and run? Why would my response be to leave other parents, other families, and other kids to deal with this, quite frankly, very racist policy? I'm not going to do it, and no other person should have to do it.
Now, Butler High School's principal has called for a meeting about it Friday afternoon.
It's about policing our kids' hair, and I don't want our kids' hair to be policed. They're already policed enough.
The district says it is also reaching out to all school SBDM councils to have them review their own dress code policies. Reporting from Butler High School, Rachel Collier, WDRB News.
As you can imagine, there's a lot of people commenting on this on social media. Hillary says, read the rules or dress code. If you are not willing to abide by them, apply to a different school. Jennifer writes, it's a racist, stupid policy for a public school to have, regardless of how long it's been in place. Brad says, maybe they just want the kids to look respectable, look like respectable young men and ladies, thereby promoting a more respectable learning atmosphere. And Carrie says, the school board needs to worry about educating our children, not controlling how they dress. A look.
I'm not sure anymore just how it happened before. The places that I knew was sunny and blue. I can feel it deep inside, this black nigger's pride. I have no fear when I say, and I said every day, every nigger is a star. Every nigger is a star. Who will deny that you and I and every nigger is a star?
New video tonight of a passenger on board a flight in Charlotte just moments before authorities say that he assaulted a flight attendant. He appeared in federal court just hours ago.
Eyewitness News reporter Jim Bradley has the new details of the chaos on that plane. Jim.
Yeah, Erica, Michael Kerr was subdued as he made that appearance here at the federal courthouse today. Not at all like the man FBI agents described, as somebody who attacked flight attendants on an American Airlines flight that landed here in Charlotte, all the while passengers had cell phones out recording. This cell phone video taken by another passenger shows Michael Kerr refusing to sit down as a flight from Kentucky pulled up to the gate in Charlotte. Kerr can be seen sitting on the armrest of another passenger's seat and then barging up the aisle. Court documents say Kerr had 3 Jack Daniels drinks, and when he was told to sit down again,
He allegedly threatened to break the flight attendant's jaw. Another flight attendant, who's from Charlotte, didn't want to comment today, but her brother says she told him Kerr's behavior got worse.
He called her the N-word.
Nigga!
He kicked her, he hit her, he punched her, and then he charged her and knocked her to the floor.
Federal agents say it took two pilots to wrestle Kerr down and hold him face down in the aisle with his hands restrained while flight crew members wrapped a seatbelt strap around Kerr's ankles. Public defender Peter Adolf, who represented Kerr today in court but only just met him, says he still has little information about Kerr's side of the story.
Anything to explain his behavior?
No.
The flight attendants union says it's concerned about an increasing number of assaults by passengers.
When we go to work every day, we know that in a confined cabin space with more people crammed into a smaller area than ever, we are de-escalating situations all day long.
Now, in court today, the judge told Michael Kerr he faces up to 20 years in prison for these charges. He is still in the Mecklenburg County Jail, will remain there till another hearing next week. As for the flight attendant, her brother tells me she's out of the hospital, on leave, and beginning physical therapy. Live at the courthouse, I'm Jim Bradley, Channel 9 Witness News.
Yes, every nigga is a star. Every nigga is a star. Yes, every nigga is a star.
When are we as black people going to have the level of self-respect and courage to really come out of the slave role, slave obey your master, turn the other cheek. Make certain you turn the other cheek and you'll get your reward in heaven. And that's a slave role. We haven't maybe thought about it in those terms.
Well, there's been a lot of talk this week about a story Channel 4 was first to report. You may remember a restaurant server in Murfreesboro was fired after describing her customers with the N-word on social media. That got attention. But the post that followed from one of those customers is catching on like wildfire. Channel 4's Liz Loheis joins us now with the story.
Demetria, her server called her the N-word. Chelsea Mays responded by telling her she loved her. The post has gone viral, and the story has been picked up by CNN, The Washington Post, and BET. I spoke with that customer tonight, Chelsea. She's not looking for airtime. She's looking for understanding.
Chelsea Mays and Denitra Kent left their server a big tip. First in the form of money.
Sweet. She was very nice, hands-on.
Then later, in the form of advice.
Having hate in your heart like that, it doesn't hurt anybody but yourself.
The women were part of this group of five who grabbed lunch at Cheddar's after church on Sunday. Later that night, this post popped up on their Facebook feeds.
Like, there was no doubt in my mind that's our waitress. She was just serving us. Wow, this is how she felt the whole time.
But instead of blasting the server on her social media, Chelsea took the high road.
I've experienced a lot of grace and mercy in my life, so I can only extend that to her.
On her Facebook page, Chelsea directly addressed the waitress, telling her she was praying for her and she loved her.
But hopefully with my response, you'll see that it wasn't okay, and at the end of the day, I can still love you for it.
Someone else said, well done, how you handled the situation. Always rise above ignorance and bigotry.
Chelsea has heard from thousands. Most of the feedback has been positive. And their story has been told nationally.
I feel like God put us at that table for a reason, because we don't know how somebody else would have reacted to this. All I can speak of is for how we reacted.
No one in the group has heard from that server, but they've already made peace.
I have already forgiven her. Even if I never hear from her again, I never hear an apology, I forgive her.
Again, that waitress has been fired, and the owner of Cheddar says he too was offended.
I am not prejudiced.
For the past 10 years, Polpeter has been analyzing evidence here at the DCI Crime Lab in Ankeny and often testifying as an expert for the state at criminal trials. But DPS officials say Polpeter broke the code of conduct policy when she posted on social media. On July 8th, Polpeter wrote on her personal Facebook page in response to the Dallas police officer shootings, saying in part, "Until a few years ago, I never really saw the color of a person's skin. They were all just people to me. But because of blacks, I now do notice the color of skin. And frankly, I no longer feel safe around them. Yes, not every black person is going to shoot me because I look at them or because I happen to be attending a training, so I'm wearing a DCI shirt that day. But I know there is a stronger chance they will today than they would have 5 years ago.
And I think in this case that the state did the right thing and held her responsible for her words.
Jill Swaggerman, an employment attorney not involved in this case, says Polpeter should have been fired because of her posts.
They suggest some real bias towards African Americans. And in a position that she had as a criminologist with the state, that is very concerning.
Legal experts say these posts could have a huge impact on criminal cases Polpeter has worked on, because now defense attorneys can question her credibility.
An effective defense lawyer would really go after this because it demonstrates the possibility that someone may have been biased in how they arrived at their conclusion.
Michael runs in and jams at the other end.
He finally spoke up. Michael Jordan, the man who many people consider to be the greatest NBA player of all time, released a statement today to The Undefeated saying,
"As a proud American, a father who lost his own dad in a senseless act of violence, and a black man, I have been deeply troubled by the deaths of African Americans at the hands of law enforcement and angered by the cowardly and hateful targeting and killing of police. I grieve with the families who have lost loved ones, as I know their pain all too well."
Wow. For a guy who very famously stayed away from politics even while kids were killing each other for his sneakers, and still are, by the by, this is a major step forward. Jordan also said that he plans to donate $1 million to both the Institute for Community Police Relations and the NAACP's Legal Defense Fund. Look, say what you want about number 23 being 20 years too late with his activism. I see all you people making fun of him on Twitter. At least the man is trying to do something, which is a lot more than many with his kind of clout can say for themselves. I'm Clinton Yates, and that's my take.
So I've always been very respectful of athletes. I mean, a guy like Jordan, right, who was just an extraordinary athlete, and generally I think is a really kind of down to earth guy. I mean, just a hell of a competitor. Maybe politically we probably have some different issues, and I don't even know. I had a couple of just off the record conversations with Jordan back, you know. And I think he knows what the deal is.
Right.
He knows what the Jordan, some brothers you talk to, and they really don't know what the deal is. Right. Others you talk to, they know. They just say, "Listen, this is how I'm playing this."
Right.
Because I want the dough, the money, and all that kind of
right.
stuff.
So he was no dummy.
No. He was very perceptive about right. what was going on. But I think he was also, you know, like he knew, you know, he was about the dough, and he knows at some level if you want. You know, you certain things you're just not going to say. Like, you know, the whole thing about, you know, we haven't even gotten to Harry. We haven't got to the news of the day. You know, Michael right. Jordan, Michael Jordan speaks.
Right. Well, right. Actually, or speak, or his money talked again.
Yeah. He, I guess you could, what's the news of the day?
Jordan donated $2 million to the cause. He spoke out for the first time, maybe ever, on a racial issue. And he donated $2 million, $1 million going to the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, which is great, you know, as far as I'm concerned. They've done great work. It was founded by Thurgood Marshall. My father worked there for about 9-10 years. So I know firsthand the kind of work they do, and they can definitely use $1 million. And he also he donated the other million to the Institute for Community and Police Relations, which was launched by the International Association of Chiefs of Police. And that's an organization that, you know, as you can tell by the name, is a new organization that's supposed to help community police relations. So he donated a big chunk of cash, and at the same time sort of spoke out. He took kind of both sides of the issue. He said he could relate to both sides, basically. He could relate to the police fears, and he could relate to the fears of young black youth out there, but you know, I think it's a positive overall. I mean, he spoke out, and he put some money out there that would probably be, that I know as far as the LDF, will be put to a good use.
Yeah, so I mean, I think you have to filter these things through a positive prism. I mean,
absolutely
right. I mean,
yeah.
you could nitpick on anything.
Right,
as people have, so I think it's positive that and Michael was being kind of true to Michael, that he wasn't pissing anybody off, you right. know, he was taking both sides,
right?
You know, I'm for you, but I'm for you too,
right?
You know, I love Christmas, you know, you know, So it was a good thing. I think that I was having this debate with my wife Sharon, and I was saying, "Well,
who's here?"
Oh, Sharon, good. Because I was wondering how am I going to pay for this bill. So first of all, I think that what Michael did was, I know a lot of people say, "Oh, he should have been doing this 20 years ago." Well, everything in everybody's time. I mean,
right.
You evolve, just like Carmelo Anthony when he was 20, he was talking about don't snitch, you know, that kind of stuff.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Now 32. He's really become sort of a voice for athletes, you know, being part of the discourse. Mm-hmm. And I think what has happened, though, and I thought about this, too, in a way that because Michael still is about the money. You know, he's not going to let anything get in the way of the money. Mm-hmm. So I'm saying, well, when Michael weighs in, it's sort of the official commodification of athletic protests. I mean, you know, we have now moved into the commercialization of protests. Well, I think what people realize, like when they did it during the ESPYs, that you're not going to lose your endorsements.
Right.
You're not going to be punished. This ain't 1968 with Smith and Carlos and all that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That you guys are making too much money for these. Well, you know, ain't nobody. In fact, in this environment, I think this is what Trump is about. That anything is. You could sell anything, as long as it's kind of out and bubbling, whatever, everything is good. It's all good. So if you protest, it's all good. If you don't, and it's almost, I was thinking that because of the ESPYs and all that, probably a lot of the agents, yeah, they're telling their clients, well, why don't you protest? I mean, you gotta make a statement. You know, why don't you say something? Why don't you make a statement? Because now you don't want to be perceived as an Uncle Tom. I mean, now you want to perceive like you're down with the community. You know, as opposed to before, remember, it was like you don't want to rock the boat. And right. You don't want to be thought. Well, now because of the grassroots, people are like, well, where do you stand? Well, you saw what Beyonce did at the Super Bowl, and you saw what the brother did at the Emmy Award. The actor
from Grey's Anatomy.
Right.
Yeah, well, him, but the guy who did a tremendous video. I'm forgetting his name. But the response.
People are stepping up.
Well, it's stepping up and also realize you're not losing your endorsements.
Right.
If anything else, now you're authentic.
Right. I mean, but most of the people are stepping up. I hear what you're saying, that, you know, people are going to be coming in after them, and then we really don't know, you know, how down for the cause they really are. It's a little easier to step up now. But the initial people, like a Carmelo, the four guys at the, you know, LeBron, Chris Paul, Dwayne Wade at the ESPYs, and you know, it's been a debate whether, you know, how big a deal that was, but hey, they did it,
right.
and they stepped up. It wasn't being done before that, so I give them their credit, and even like you said, even Jordan deserves credit. He made a statement,
right.
And for him, that's a big step.
Yeah. So that's what I think. I think the first thing you have to say is it's a good thing. It's a
right.
positive thing. You know, I don't think you have to. I don't think you should start with a critique or with a criticism. I think the first thing is that it's good. And frankly, the reason why we've survived for 400 years is because we're not a monolith. We all come from different.
And they're still getting that backlash from the fans, as you are used to getting. Stick to sports. We don't want to hear this. Their Twitter accounts are being there's a barrage of negativity coming to their Twitter accounts. So there is some sort of backlash that they do get for speaking out.
You know, when I worked, I ain't your slave, right? You know, I ain't shucking and jiving and high fiving. You know, this ain't back in the days, right? Well, I can't tell how the way they kill Freddie Gray, right?
Good morning. Thank you all for being here. Today, Baltimore finds itself at the epicenter of a national conflict between urban and rural populations of color and the law enforcement agencies that are sworn to protect and serve them. It is a struggle that strikes at the basic ideas of self-determination, justice, equality, and sadly, humanity in America. However fitting it is for observers to use the untimely death of Freddie Carlos Gray Jr. as a barometer of our nation's progress on police brutality, my professional role in this matter is plain: to seek justice on behalf of an innocent 25-year-old man who was unreasonably taken into custody after fleeing in his neighborhood, which just happens to be a high-crime neighborhood, and had his spine partially severed in the back of a Baltimore police wagon. As the chief prosecutor for Baltimore City, I took an oath to uphold justice and to treat every individual within my jurisdiction equally and fairly under the law. I take my oath very seriously. Since the start of my administration, we have been and continue to be wholly committed to creating a fair and equitable justice system for all and holding people accountable for crimes that they commit regardless of age, race, color, sex, creed, socioeconomic status, or in this case, occupation. As a chief prosecutor elected by the people of Baltimore City, I made a promise that my prosecutors and I will never cower from our obligation to prosecute crimes where we believe that we have probable cause that a crime was committed. We're sworn to not only uphold the law and hold violent repeat offenders accountable, but we're also sworn to apply justice fairly and equally to everyone, even those that take an oath to protect and serve our communities. As prosecutors, we are servants of all victims and witnesses of crime in Baltimore City, and we fight each and every day to ensure that perpetrators of crime see their day in court and are held accountable for their actions or inactions where there's a relational duty that requires such. We never cowered in our battle for justice for 16-year-old Felicia Barnes, 1-year-old Carter Scott, bicyclist and loving father Thomas Palermo, or Shatia Lansdowne and the various other sexual assault survivors of Nelson Clifford. As I previously stated, the decision to prosecute 6 police officers was not and has never been an indictment on the entire Baltimore Police Department. Although some have tried to invalidate my family's longstanding service as public officers, I know firsthand the sacrifices, the dedication, the commitment it takes to protect and serve our communities. For those that believe that I'm anti-police, it's simply not the case. I'm anti-police brutality, and I need not remind you that the only loss and the greatest loss in all of this was that of Freddie Gray's life. For over a year, my office has been forced to remain silent on all 6 of the cases pertaining to and surrounding the death of Freddie Gray. Despite being physically and professionally threatened, mocked, ridiculed, harassed, and even sued, we've respected and fulfilled our obligation in dutiful silence in accordance with Judge Barry Williams' gag order, restricting any commentary from the state. In accordance with my oath to pursue justice over convictions, I've refused to allow the grandstanding of some and the hyperbole of others to diminish our resolve to seek justice on behalf of this young man. I was elected the prosecutor. I signed up for this, and I can take it. Because no matter how problematic and troublesome it has been for my office, my prosecutors, my family, and me personally, it pales in comparison to what mothers and fathers all across this country, specifically Freddie Gray's mother, Gloria Darden, or Richard Shipley, Freddie Gray's stepfather, goes through on a daily basis, knowing their son's mere decision to run from the police proved to be a lethal one. Please know that even though the media has made this about everything but the untimely death of your son, my office has never wavered in our commitment to seeking justice on his behalf. My team of prosecutors, led by 2 highly respected veteran attorneys, Chief Deputy Michael Schatzow, Deputy State's Attorney Janice Bledsoe, right here, and Assistant State's Attorney John Butler, Matt Pillion, Sarah Akhtar, Law Clerk Michael Fiorenza, have devoted countless hours and made countless sacrifices to ensure accountability on your son's behalf. I'm extremely proud of my team, who never lost sight of why we were fighting so hard, your son. As the world has witnessed over the past 14 months, the prosecution of on-duty police officers in this country is unsurprisingly rare and blatantly fraught with systemic and inherent complications.
Yes, it is.
Unlike with other cases where prosecutors work closely with the police to investigate what actually occurred, what we realized very early on in this case was that investigating police, whether they're friends or merely their colleagues, was problematic.
That's right, that's right.
There was a reluctance and an obvious bias that was consistently exemplified not by the entire Baltimore Police Department, but by individuals within the Baltimore Police Department at every stage of the investigation, which became blatantly apparent in the subsequent trials. Although Commissioner Davis was and has been extremely accommodating, There were individual police officers that were witnesses to the case, yet were part of the investigative team. Interrogations that were conducted without asking the most poignant questions. Lead detectives that were completely uncooperative and started a counter-investigation to disprove the state's case by not executing search warrants pertaining to text messages among the police officers involved in the case, creating videos to disprove the state's case without our knowledge, creating notes that were drafted after the case was launched to contradict the medical examiner's conclusion, turning these notes over to defense attorneys months prior to turning them over to the state, and yet doing it in the middle of trial. As you can see, whether investigating, interrogating, testifying, cooperating, or even complying with the state, we've all bore witness to an inherent bias that is a direct result of when police police themselves. And despite the challenges of not having an independent investigatory agency to work with us throughout this prosecution, we still are grateful for the opportunity to show the world the reality of the justice system from start to finish. At every step of the way, due process was afforded all of these officers, and the legitimacy of our prosecution efforts were affirmed time and time again. They were affirmed when the court commissioner signed off on the charges that we filed. They were yet again affirmed when we presented our case before a grand jury and secured indictments against all six officers in every charge that we presented to them. Our legal arguments, theories, strategies were affirmed not only in 135 motions in which we successfully overcame, but also in the state's highest court, where we battled and ultimately prevailed in compelling the officers to testify against each other. The legitimacy of these charges were even affirmed by the judge after he rejected 13 motions for dismissal and denied 22 motions for judgment of acquittal throughout all four trials. As prosecutors, we are ministers of justice, and it is our ethical obligation to always seek justice over convictions. As prosecutors, we do not determine guilt or innocence of individuals, but rather present evidence to a judge or a jury to make that determination. In these cases, my prosecutors presented a great deal of evidence to support the charges alleged. And although we came close to convicting one of the officers when his case was tried before 12 Baltimore City residents, the judge, who is within his right, has made it clear that he doesn't agree with the state's theory of the case and does not believe that any of the actions or inactions of these officers rise to the level of criminality. The judge has acquitted three of these officers, one of the arresting officers, the wagon driver, the highest-ranking police officer in these matters. In light of these consistent outcomes, the likelihood of the remaining defendant's decision to elect a bench trial with this very same judge is highly probable, and unfortunately, so is the outcome.
You did the right thing.
And while to this day we stand by the decisions, the legal theories, the charges, and assertions set forth in the statement of probable cause and during these proceedings, as officers of the court, we must respect the verdicts rendered by the judge regarding the ultimate culpability of the adjudicated officers involving Freddie Gray's death as final, no matter how much we may disagree with his rulings. We do not believe that Freddie Gray killed himself. We stand by the medical examiner's determination that Freddie Gray's death was a homicide. However, after much thought and prayer, it has become clear to me that without being able to work with an independent investigatory agency from the very start, without having a say in the election of whether our cases proceed in front of a judge or a jury, without communal oversight of policing in this community, without real substantive reforms to the current criminal justice system, we could try this case 100 times and cases just like it, and we would still end up with the same result. Accordingly, I have decided not to proceed on the cases against Officer Garrett, Sergeant Alicia White, or to relitigate the case against William Porter. As a mother, the decision not to proceed on these trials, on the remaining trials, is agonizing. However, as a chief prosecutor elected by the citizens of Baltimore, I must consider the dismal likelihood of conviction at this point. The judicial economy in proceeding further and the divisive impact that continuing this prosecution could potentially have on our community. What I've ultimately learned throughout this arduous process is that although no small task, justice is always worth the price paid for its pursuit. You see, in spite of the fact that the verdicts didn't go in our favor, there have been many gains throughout this journey to ensure that what happened to Freddie Gray never happens to another person that comes into contact with police, justifiably or unjustifiably again. Never again should there be a question as to why someone is being stopped, detained, or arrested due to the fact that there will now soon be full implementation of body-worn cameras on all officers. Never again should someone be placed unsecured and defenseless in a metal wagon head first, feet shackled and handcuffed. Due to the fact that officers are now required to secure and seatbelt all prisoners. Never again should there be a need to rely on circumstantial evidence to observe what takes place inside police wagons due to the fact that cameras are now equipped in every one of them. Never again should an officer ignore or neglect a prisoner's request for medical attention to no avail due to the fact that it is now mandatory for officers to call a medic when requested. Never again should a commanding officer or a rank and file officer be able to assert that they are unaware of departmental policies, general orders, or procedures due to the fact that there is now a software verification and accountability system to ensure their adherence. Never again should an officer exhibit a blatant or reckless disregard for human life due to the fact that there are now use of force policies that emphasize the sanctity of life, accentuates de-escalation, and requires that officers intervene if fellow officers cross the line. You see, what I've learned through this experience is that every battle, every hurdle, every obstacle that we've overcome since the pursuit of these cases has brought us one step closer to equality, and that any and every step towards equality in our justice system is well worth fighting for. This system is in need of reform, and when it comes to police accountability, and as long as I'm the chief prosecutor for this city, I vow to you that my office and I will fight. We will fight for a fair and equitable justice system for all, so that whatever happened to Freddie Gray never happens to another person in this community again. Thank you.
Fiery Marilyn Mosby.
I'm not taking any questions due to the fact that I have current civil litigation pending against me as a result of this prosecution.
Well, I can't tell how the way they killed Freddie Gray, right? Shot down Mike Brown, how they did Trey, right?
A spokesperson for a Fox News affiliate in St. Louis says one of its reporters no longer works for the station after he made a joke about Michael Brown's death on social media. The unarmed teenager was shot and killed by a police officer in August of 2014 in Ferguson, Missouri. Reporter Bobby Hughes mocked Brown's mother, Leslie McSpadden, on Facebook after learning that she would be appearing at the Democratic National Convention. In one post, Hughes said she's going to talk about the new lead diet she's endorsed. 5 servings, and you can lose 200 pounds in 2 years easily. Hughes has since apologized for his comments.
We were actually informed that she only had a half an hour. But once she got there, Hillary actually sat there and listened to each and every one of our stories. She showed respect, empathy. We seen the loving mother part of her. It wasn't about politics.
A 30-minute meeting turned into 2 hours because she listened to us. Nobody else listened to us.
11 times he said he couldn't drive.
My son had 21 bullet holes.
It seems like people are just getting away with it.
From your perspective, what can we do? Mm-hmm. Well, I think you can continue to speak out, but you will be more effective if you do somehow band together so that it's a constant drumbeat as to say, look, we are citizens, we are mothers, We lost children. This is not only wrong, it is unacceptable. And here are the things that need to happen to try to prevent this from ever happening again.
It's all of us. We're trying to keep our kids' memory alive. We're trying to keep their name alive. And so I need to speak so that her voice can remain.
I can't help Trayvon at this time, but there are other Trayvon Martins that I can help.
I believe in my heart that Dontre was a seed planted so me and these different moms could actually be our loved ones' voices, to actually get real change. Our ancestors fought and fought and fought, and it's been 400 years, and I just want us to love one another. I want people to stop hating one another, stop taking from each other. Let's build. Let's unite.
Pastor, would you mind giving us a prayer before we go out?
I would so appreciate it. These people here are among some of the people that I just treasure and admire so much.
Let us pray. God, our Father, we come now to praise yourself.
Hello. Hello. Hey, I need you all to hear me tonight. Give me 2 moments to tell you how good God is. Whew. Hallelujah. Give me a moment to say thank you. We are not standing here because he's not good. We're standing here because he's great. Whew. 1 year ago, yesterday, I lived the worst nightmare anyone could imagine. I watched as my daughter, Sandra Bland, was lowered into the ground in a coffin. She was my fourth of 5 daughters, and she was gone. No, not on administrative leave, but on permanent leave from this earth. Found hanging in a jail cell after an unlawful traffic stop and an unlawful arrest. 6 other women have died in custody that same month. Kendra Chapman, Alexis McGovern, Sarah Lee Circlebear, Raynette Turner, Ralkina Jones, and Joyce Cornell. So many of our children are gone, but they are not forgotten. I am here with Hillary Clinton tonight. Because she is a leader and a mother who will say our children's names. She knows that when a young black life is cut short, it's not just a loss. It's a personal loss. It's a national loss. It's a loss that diminishes all of us. What a blessing tonight to be standing here so that Sandy can still speak through her mama. And what a blessing it is for all of us that we have the opportunity. If we seize it, we gotta seize it. To cast our votes for a president who will help lead us down the path toward restoration and change.
You don't stop being a mom when your child dies. You don't stop being a parent. I am still Jordan Davis's mother. His life ended the day that he was shot and killed for playing loud music. But my job as his mother didn't. I still wake up every day thinking about how to parent him, how to protect him and his legacy, how to ensure that his death doesn't overshadow his life. Here's what you don't know about my son. When Jordan was little, he wouldn't eat a popsicle unless he had enough to bring out to his friends. He loved practical jokes. He liked having deep conversations with me about our love for God and how God could allow such pain and suffering. I lived in fear that my son would die like this. I even warned him that because he was a young black man, he would meet people who didn't value him or his life. That is a conversation that no parent should ever have with their child. Hillary Clinton isn't afraid to say that Black Lives Matter. She isn't afraid to sit at a table with grieving mothers and bear the full force of our anguish. She doesn't build walls around her heart. Not only did she listen to our problems, she invited us to become a part of the solution. And that's what we're going to do. We're going to keep telling our children's stories, and we're urging you to say their names. We're going to keep building a future where police officers and communities of color work together in mutual respect to keep children like Jordan safe. The majority of police officers are good people doing a good job. And we're also going to keep using our voices and our votes to support leaders like Hillary Clinton, who will help us protect one another so that this club of heartbroken mothers stops growing.
First of all, I'd like to say it's an honor to be here to stand with these mothers and be amongst you. I am an unwilling participant in this movement. I would not have signed up for this or any other mother that's standing here with me today. But I am here today for my son, Trayvon Martin, who is in heaven. And also for his brother, Javaris Fulton, who is still here on Earth. I did not want this spotlight, but I will do everything I can to focus some of this light on the pain of a path out of the darkness. Hillary Clinton has the compassion and understanding to support grieving mothers. She has the courage to lead the fight for common sense gun legislation. She has a plan to divide that so often exists between law enforcement and the communities that they serve. This isn't about being politically correct. This is about saving our children. That's why we're here tonight with Hillary Clinton. And that's why, in memory of our children, we are imploring you, all of you, to vote this election day. Yeah. Hillary is one mother who can ensure our movement will succeed. I want to thank you for standing with us and supporting us. And we like to leave with you what God has given us: strength, love, and peace. Thank you.
Well, we are joined by radio from inside a state prison in Pennsylvania by Mumia Abu-Jamal, a former colleague of mine here in Philadelphia. We were both journalists together here in the 1970s, perhaps the most well-known political prisoner in the United States, award-winning journalist who's writing from his prison cell, has reached a worldwide audience through his prison radio commentaries and many books. Abu-Jamal was convicted of the 1981 murder of Philadelphia police officer Daniel Faulkner, but has always maintained his innocence. Amnesty International has found he was deprived of a fair trial. Mumia Abu-Jamal joins us now on the phone from SCI Mahoney State Prison in Frackville, Pennsylvania. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Mumia.
Hola, hola, Juan, everyone, Larry, everyone, on the move. How y'all doing?
Mumia, we're interested in your thoughts on the convention occurring right here in your hometown.
It's a hell of a show, but it is a show. And, you know, I mean, it has writers and directors and stage managers, and it's a hell of a show. But never forget, it's just a show.
What do you think of not only what's happening on the inside? I mean, we just broadcast today.
Pennsylvania State Correctional Institution, Mahanoy.
This call is subject to recording and monitoring.
That's the recording that comes on over the call. So very quickly, Mumia, there's not only action on the floor of the Democratic Convention, but thousands of people have been marching in the streets.
I think that's extraordinary, and I think that's where the real action is. While I said the convention is a show, and who can doubt that, what's happening in the streets of Philadelphia, that's where the real story is, because those are the voices you won't hear throughout these 4 days of gala, extravaganza, lies, and illusion, because you're hearing the pain of the people. The real concerns of the people, and really the desperation of the people to be heard by the rich and the powerful. You look inside, you'll see the powerful. You'll see millionaires, right? We have an incredible system right now. Millionaires running against billionaires. Well, who's not in that picture? And that's the 99%, the rest of us, you know.
Mamie, I'm sure you also monitored the Republican convention that occurred last week, and Donald Trump emphasizing that he is the law and order candidate. And I'm sure that it reminded you of a person that we were familiar with right here in Philadelphia, the mayor of Philadelphia, Frank Rizzo, who was the ultimate law and order candidate. For those of the younger generation who are not familiar with Rizzo, any similarities between some of the stuff that you remember from him and Donald Trump?
I mean, Frank Rizzo was authentically working class. You know, he rose from the bottom of the police department to become its commissioner and then was elected mayor. And, you know, I thought about Frank Rizzo when I first heard that Donald Trump was running. And I had the same reaction when I heard that Frank Rizzo was running for mayor. I laughed. I'm like, here was a guy, high school dropout, nothing personal, but it's true. And here's a guy who is like dumb as rocks about everything other than making money, or taking money, I should say. But I stopped laughing. You know, I thought about when Ronald Reagan ran for president, this grade B actor. I laughed. I stopped laughing. And when you look at this guy, he's like Frank Rizzo with billions and billions of dollars in his pocket. But if you kind of turned off the screen and listened to the words, it's the same message. Fear, 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 fear of the other, fear of blacks, and only I can save you. It's kind of a mixture of Frank Rizzo, Goldwater, Spiro Agnew, Dick Cheney, you know, and Hitler.
Mumia, you recently did a commentary on the killings of police officers in Baton Rouge and Dallas. Share your thoughts on this.
Well, I think one of the lines I used in that commentary is why should any of us be surprised? Whenever that happens, what you'll hear, especially among elite opinion on TV, is that this was a madman. This was a crazy person. If he was mad, how did he get accepted into the Army? How did he serve tours in Afghanistan or Iraq? Both of these men displayed military training that they acquired from the U.S. government, and as they became killers in the Third World. When they came back to the United States and they saw their reality, do you think that drove them crazy? And, you know, something like 22 veterans commit suicide every day in America. And that's because of the horrible things they've been asked to do by empire abroad. And, you know, when you look at the condition of black people in America, mass incarceration gone crazy, ghettos being policed as if it is Fallujah or a foreign nation, why would you be surprised? They were trained by the state to do exactly what they did, and they did it.
Mumia, we are speaking to you from Hanoi State Prison. You used to be on death row for 2 decades. I think ultimately, perhaps, though, it was the judicial system. It was enormous international pressure that led to you being taken off of death row. How is your health now? For a period of time, we didn't know what was happening, diabetes, eczema. How are you being dealt with? How is health care there? What are you asking for?
Well, for a while there, I didn't know what was happening. I had diabetes. I had extreme high blood pressure. My skin was falling to my feet. I was itching in an insane degree. What we learned through this litigation is that I had hepatitis C that to this date has not been treated. I've probably been given more treatment for my symptoms, right, than perhaps any other prisoner in Pennsylvania. That's true. but I've yet to be treated for that disease. And the state, in their latest brief to the court, said if the plaintiff prevails, it'll cost the DOC over $600 million. I can't make this up. It's probably online. That's only because they claim there are some 6,000 men and probably women in the Pennsylvania system who have hepatitis C, and very few of them are treated. On the stand, we asked him, the head of the DOC's medical division, Dr. Peter Noel, how many people are being treated with these new antiviral medications? And he said, I don't know. He said, well, can you give us your best guess? He said, five or six. Five or six out of 6,000. What we also learned is they have a protocol. It was a secret protocol that we learned about at that hearing, that men and women who have hepatitis C must wait until something called esophageal varices are detected. That's when you're bleeding from your esophagus out of your mouth, which means, of course, that your liver is, for all intents and purposes, dead. That's why you're bleeding out of your mouth, because you can't process, your liver can't process your blood. It's rejecting it. That's when you'll be considered to be put on a list for treatment. That's stage four,
Denny,
liver disease.
Any comments you want to share with Mumia Abu-Jamal?
Well, first of all, I was just thinking about his health, and essentially, and I think for us to be practical, they're trying to kill him right there before eyes. Certainly, his analysis of what has happened and what is happening here is right on point. I was at an event at a church on Broad Street where men and women were there, particularly women were there. And certainly it was for them and their voices of women. One of the women who was there, father had been a political prisoner for 42 years. So that's the place where everything is happening. Code Pink had a sign saying feminism, not militarism. They were promoting that. That's where the real convention is. There were the people who are still fighting, who want their voices to be heard. And our responsibility, the work that Larry does and the work that we have to do as progressives, is about that. I was just thinking also about what W.B. Du Bois wrote in his 1953 reissue of The Souls on Black Folks after 50 years, when he talked about how his thinking at that time was that the question of the century was race. The question of the century, said, is still race. But what he didn't know then is that how people would be able to manage to live and to go on with their lives, go on with their lives in the midst of all the pain, in the midst of all the wars. That's the thing that we have to consume ourselves with in terms of whether it's the war in our cities or the war abroad or the destabilization of governments, et cetera, et cetera.
Mumia Abu-Jamal, I know we just have 15 seconds. Do you believe the issue of the 21st century, the problem of the 21st century, is still the color line?
I think it's a color line, but it's also the class line. We've just experienced a black president, but black Americans, in the words of Young Jeezy, for the most part, are still living in hell.
You have 1 minute
left. Well, we want to thank you for joining us, Mumia Abu-Jamal. Your last 20 seconds that we have for this broadcast.
I would urge anyone who has a computer or a way to acquire The Nation of February 10th, 2016, the article by Michelle Alexander entitled Why Hillary Clinton Doesn't Deserve the Black Vote. It is incredible. I thank you all. I love you all. Larry, pleasure hearing you again, brother. Everybody, I love you. Thank you for this time with you. On the move.
On the move. Context of white supremacy.
Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, July 30th, 2016. So I have been told. Compensatory call-in. Looking forward to hearing views, observations, suggestions from non-white listeners, victims of racism. Feel free to dial the number 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. That number again, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. If you could please watch the background noise when you dial in, if you know you're in a loud environment, televisions are on or what have you, other people are talking in the background, if you could use your mute button, that would be great. And then just unmute yourself whenever you have comments that you would like to share. Also ask if people could kind of make their comments about 5 minutes. I'll try to watch the time, make sure we get everybody in who has commentary that they would like to share. Really appreciate that. Certainly we say consistently for all of the compensatory call-ins each Saturday, no metaphors. If you can be specific, direct to what it is that you would like to articulate, if it's a view or suggestion. Just frequently, when people discuss white supremacy racism, metaphors are employed. They are not accurate. They obscure clarity, truth. Consistently, I think racists do this deliberately to cause confusion, so that non-white listeners do not get an accurate understanding of what is being said. I think a lot of times non-white people, including myself, just in our confusion about racism, white supremacy, and our victimization, sometimes we use metaphors trying to explain, articulate what is happening to us, suggestions about what should be done, just because we are still ourselves trying to get clarity about what racism, white supremacy is and how it works. But please, no metaphors. Much appreciated. The only thing I will say, because we had some lengthier clips of the the news section went a little longer than normal. The only thing that I will say, the black mothers that spoke at the Democratic National Convention, they were the mothers of Eric Garner, Trayvon Martin, Jordan Davis, Mike Brown, Hadiyah Pendleton, Dontre Hamilton, and Sandra Bland. The assortment branded by the Hillary Clinton campaign, branded the mothers of the movement. We will hit the phone lines. The first collection of folks who dialed in with a hand up, your line should be open. We'll just kind of go down the line and get everybody as they dial in with a hand up. So the first set of folks who dialed in with a hand up should be with us. If you have commentary you would like to share, feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I have a family event to go to, so I'll try to be brief. But I had to sit down because, wow. You sure did find a collection of things to talk about today, Gus. And I just heard at this family event, my family tried to get me to vote for Hillary Clinton, and I'm saying to myself, really? Really? And now she really did. She really is playing a number. I really hope she's able to carry out what she pushing. Because if she won't, it's going to be real tragic. It's going to be real tragic the next get-together, because I don't know, I'm going to have a few words to say, I'm pretty sure, the next time. But I'm being quiet right now. But as far as the update for the issue with my land situation, a white man has gotten control of the land through other means. He has seemingly has bought the land from this group that bought the land from the city illegally, and he has gotten the land now. So we're under, quote unquote, a promise to split the land up. So we're still waiting for that process to go through. But they have sold him the land, and so he has control of the land, and still I have not been notified of any type of sale of this land. So they got a real slick situation that they got going on. I ran into another brother who had the same situation, and I guess this has been going on with other black people in the city. So I got to be in contact with them to see how far this this game goes, see how long we've been doing it for. So that's the update there. But, yeah, I think I'm going to have to mute. But before I go, I want to talk about the sister out of Baltimore. She put on one good speech, but that's pretty much all it was. I mean, there was no real solution or she's not really even telling us, okay, how what kind of remedy you could go for this type of problem. What can be your remedy? Just be happy with what you got. And that's not going to be enough. So, yeah. But she gave us a lot of information, or at least she told on somebody. She wasn't keeping no, what I feel, she wasn't keeping no white people secret. So, but I'm sure there's probably more that she could have told because, well, you know, she's under a penalty right now. They're about to try to punish her for her niggardly behavior. You know, go back to try to treat her like a nigger. So I'll mute myself and let somebody else try and move in.
Help you up.
You don't sound as clear.
Can I be heard?
That is better.
Yes, good evening, guys. Good evening to all the callers. Great assortment of videos. The clip, you know, they're still collected. Black people specimen and using them without paying them. You know, that gave me like a Henrietta Lacks flashback. I mean, just thinking of how much money her family is owed, you know, and who knows what they've been collecting from the rest of us. Every time we go to the doctor, give blood or whatever, what happens to the part they don't use or whatever, it's, you know, just a medical apartheid. I think you tied that in very well. Black Lives Matter now in France. So that's France, Brazil, South Africa. You know, I'm very suspicious now. You know, this has become the largest Pan-African movement since the UNIA. And I personally think Black Lives Matter was an effective tool for black people to use to solve the problem of racism and white supremacy. It wouldn't exist. It wouldn't be allowed to flourish to the point where it's become now an international organization. I'm just very, very suspicious. Michael Jordan, you know, saw him, you know, heard him give his little thing, and I read it, and, you know, all I have to say is, you know, I have a problem with black people when they describe themselves. Michael was a proud American. He's someone who lost a father to gun violence. And third, he's a black man. So that tells you where his priorities are right there. You know, he's American first. I would personally be a black man, someone who lost a father to gun violence, and a American. I wouldn't be say proud American, but I think it kind of just let everyone know exactly what order things was. You know, black man, sort of like that third thing. Yeah, and I'm a black man too, you know. As for the Baltimore DA, I believe Mosley, you know, she's in way over her head, because a black person is unqualified to hold the position she has. She doesn't have the power to do anything other than talk. And in a system of racism, white supremacy, especially in the people area of law, which is probably their most powerful part of the system, you know, that's all she can do is talk. Now, if all this stuff was done to serve the case by the cops, I haven't heard any of these cops going to jail for tampering with the case. I haven't heard any arrests being made. You know, like, if this was a white DA, this wouldn't have happened, you know? She's unqualified to do that, you know? It's just, you know, white people are sitting at home just laughing. All this policy she's talking about that's going to change, and she got all the salvation from the black people who were standing around her. You see, white people don't follow policy unless that policy is enforced by other white people. And this is the police department. They are not going to have anybody going to stand there and enforce these policies. It's just a lot of rhetoric. I like the religion of white supremacy piece. Big part of that is forgiveness. And that girl who forgave the white lady and talked about she loved her and, you know, just horrible. Lastly, the mothers of the shooting victims. You know, that was, I think Dr. Welsum said after Charlotte, listening to the families was nauseating. That's how I felt listening to these people standing there with all that church-like music in the background and clapping it up for Hillary. You know, and unfortunately, this didn't happen before Thursday, but on Friday at work, my God, I got an earful about these black mothers who talk about my ears were raped for an hour and 15 minutes by an extreme racist, and I'll make comments on that. As for Hillary Clinton, her speech, I think she did what she had to do. I don't have anything really bad to say about her speech or anything. I don't believe anything she says. But both conventions, they did a lot of racial showcasing. They'll put that black person up there. And I was shocked it happened that the Republicans with the sheriff and the guy whose father was, whose son was killed by a Mexican. But, man, I think they had more black speakers than white speakers at the Democratic convention. I mean, every time I glanced over at the TV, it was a black person talking. And I'm starting to wonder if there's still any more white Democrats. You know, it was just very odd. I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Well, sure. Other folks who dialed in who have a hand up should be with us. I will say I did also note that there were a lot of black people on display at the Democratic National Convention. In fact, I started to make a list because it was something to behold. At least the people that I saw thus far that were prominently featured, whether they actually got up and gave a speech or just made sure that they got significant amount of camera time included, not limited to, but included, Oprah Winfrey, Reverend William Barber, he's the head of the North Carolina chapter NAACP, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Congressman John Lewis, former Attorney General Eric Holder, Reverend Jesse Jackson, Lenny Kravitz, Senator Cory Booker, Morgan Freeman, First Lady Michelle Obama, and President Obama. There were others. That's just the short list. Other folks that we have not heard from who had a hand up?
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Oh, hey. Yes, I'll be quick. Well, that generally tends to happen during political conventions. You will always see more black people at a Democratic convention than a Republican convention. Because, you know, the theme for the people who run the Democratic Party is like, our convention really
looks like America. That's why you have more black people, more Asians, you know, LGBT, all of that, than you have at the Republican convention. Now, again, it's not that we as black people should vote for the Democrats over Republicans. That's just the way the conventions are ran. And as for the black press, I noticed that there were less people at the Republican convention this year. And I think that is also because, you know, Republicans are being more empowered with the white supremacist mentality. Not that the Democrats aren't either, but with Trump's racism more overt than Hillary's, you see this. And as for their speaker, Sheriff Clark, all you have to do is look at his wife to see why he was there. But it was also good to see the mothers of the movement, as these ladies are being called. Now, again, I'm not voting for Hillary, and I'm not telling anyone I know, my family, or anyone here to, but she reached out to them, and these sisters needing sympathy, you know, they took it, and can't hate them for that. So, I just can't, you know, get on them for picking someone who they feel listened to them. And as for Madam Mosby, you know, it's sad this has happened. Hopefully she will be able to keep her job. She won't be disbarred. And she did say some powerful things. And as Pastor New York said, when the other side engaged in what is clearly obstruction of justice, and she is the head prosecutor, she is the supposed head prosecutor of, you know, of Maryland, can't hold anyone accountable. This just really goes to show you how powerful system of a white supremacy is. I mean, blatant obstruction of justice, and it's tolerated. And there's, of course, these personal attacks on her as if she was not intelligent. No such attacks were given on the white Maryland prosecutor and Colt Lydus, who tried to send Joseph Walker to prison for life, even though she blew it also. But again, this is the way, you know, white DA is treated and black DA is treated. And in closing, getting back to my favorite topic for the past 20 months, two cops were shot in San Diego Thursday. One was killed, one was wounded. The cop who was killed was a Hispanic cop. The cop who was wounded is a white male. The shooter is also Hispanic. No warrant cops, no Giuliani, no Sheriff Clark, no Blue Lives Matter. Even though we're told Blue Lives Matter, their blue lives obviously didn't. That's all.
Appreciate that. Appreciate that. Other folks that we have not heard from, if you have a hand up, we have not heard from you, feel free to chime in.
Hello.
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, good evening. Thank you so much for taking my call. Hopefully everyone's doing the best that they can in the areas they are in. I'm so thankful for the clips, you know, things that you wouldn't even think to know about that we should be informed about. We are, so thank you so much for that. Going over the clips, Michael Jordan, I just say VGQ. I did not help him create his empire. I'm not going to tell him how to spend his fortune or whatever. I wasn't there, not going to be there. You know, I guess he felt what he needed to do. The thing with Roger Ailes, I think is important because it just continues to show how white lives really don't matter to white people. You know, this is a man accused of sexual harassment. If you go back to the case not too long ago in California where the young man who was supposed to be of some means raped the young lady and got no prison time. And we should learn from that they don't value each other. They do not value us. You know, I don't know what other examples can be shown. And then the contrast as compared to Bill Cosby, you know, they're like, oh, Roger Ailes, he's so important. He did all these things and he just shaped the landscape. Bill Cosby also shaped the landscape for us. I don't know what he did, but I'm very grateful personally for the show A Different World. It helped me go to a black college where I felt I got a wonderful education. I don't know what else he did, but I will always be thankful for that show. And the mothers of the movement, you know, I don't know what movement this is. It's maybe I've missed what the movement is supposed to be. If it's supposed to be about gun violence, why didn't they find all the white mothers of the Sandy Hook tragedy? You know, again, racial showcasing, racial profiling. I think some people have brought that up. And that is a strategy that is used a lot. I have an example here. I still go to school here in Memphis, and someone came to talk to our class and specifically stated on a particular issue, yes, we targeted African-American women, and he went into detail about what he did. He's like, once we get the African-American women, we can win the election. And if you think there was also an article recently in the Washington Post saying that, you know, send the most, you know, how they kind of divide everyone into groups, the group that votes the most is African-American women. So it was important for the Democrats to showcase them. I've never seen so many women, and to me, knowing that they're usually not in leadership positions, that is not a true depiction of America, as the Republicans showed a whole bunch of white people, and that is not the true face of America. And if I think of something else to say, I'll chime back in, but I can't remember right now. Thank you.
Sure, for sure. Other folks we haven't heard from, did you all have commentary?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
All right, thank you. Greetings to you, Dustin, to all the callers and the listeners. You played quite a few really, really great clips this evening. The first one I wanted to speak about was Brazil and the horrific brutalization of the women in that society. And it just really just makes me think, as a male of Caribbean descent and knowing the patriarchy that was instated with white supremacy in these areas, that's really what where the origin of all of that comes from. Even in Trinidad, I used to hear stories from a guy that my mother dated for a number of years about some of the times when he would drink. He had a drinking problem, so sometimes he would actually spend and this is before he got with my mother, but anyway, he would spend his paycheck on liquor, hanging out with the fellows after work on a Friday, and his wife would ask him about the money when he would come home so that she could take care of responsibilities or whatever. And he told one story where he just literally just blacked out on it and slapped the for asking him a question, and that was the way he instated his, I guess, that patriarchal view on her to shut her down so that she couldn't, really get to the bottom of where the money went. But she pretty much figured it out because he was drunk when he got home. But, yeah, it's just very interesting how that like just the level of brutality there is really crazy. But I think in all of those areas, Caribbean, Central America, South America, it's all the same thing. It's all white supremacy. I saw an article a few days ago that talked about when they were running the Olympic torch through different areas of Brazil, that the youth of Brazil actually stole the Olympic torch and snuffed it out and threw it and discarded it like somewhere in the bushes, and they had to actually find it, relight it, and then complete running the torch, I guess, to wherever they, you know, they have the giant torch set up. So I just found that very interesting as well, that they were able to intercept it in that way. The clip you played on France just reminded me of a story where my wife actually went there. She was visiting there. She went to Paris, and she went to England as a foreign exchange student. And while they were in Paris, they had stopped at the Eiffel Tower and all those other sightseeing places. And she said they'd go into a bathroom. And in the bathrooms, you have to tip. There's women who give out, like, napkins for you to dry your hands in the bathroom or whatever, and they usually give them a tip. So them being 15, 16-year-old girls coming from America, they really didn't know or understand that aspect of the culture. So as they found out, some of them did give this woman a tip, and one of the girls didn't, and she called the girl a monkey. So she, you know, created a big argument there in the moment, and they were able to get the girl to stop arguing with the person, to kind of leave the situation alone, being that they were in another country away from their parents. They didn't want to get into any sort of trouble, but it just brought, you know, just brought that memory to me, to my mind, in regards to the racism in France is no different than any other place dominated by white people and white supremacy. The clip you played on Marilyn Mosby, I agree with everyone's assessment. I think it's logical. She couldn't do anything. She basically, you know, I think she just laid her position out as plainly as possible so that I guess she feels that she won't be directly blamed for the way things turned out. But I just feel like in doing so, all she did was just bring herself under further scrutiny due to saying as much as she said and exposing, I guess, her thoughts, feelings, and ideas in relation to what happened. I would say it's somewhat positive, but not really productive. And in my opinion, she just brought more negative scrutiny to herself, and she actually better be careful and just be careful and look out for herself, because things can get a lot uglier than what they are now as far as just the way that she's being mistreated at this point. The clip you played with the mothers of the murdered black children and young adults was just, I think somebody talked about Dr. Wilson feeling nauseated. I was so nauseated. And, you know, VGQ, it's, you know, they're women who've lost a great deal in the form of their children being murdered by different white people and white police. So I understand and sympathize deeply with their grief. But this is just racial showcasing and white validation. I mean, just listening to them speak about how Hillary listened to her, one of the parents just really made me think of, you know, just a slave saying, "Master, listen to me." You know, like, he just sat there and he listened to what I had to say, and he made me feel like, you know, more than 3/5 of a man. So, you know, he's a good master. And it's just the worst, form of white validation and just Hillary pandering and utilizing that white validation. I think Bill Clinton is a masterful teacher, because she, I think, has taken that same approach that he took to a whole nother level with this campaign. And I just don't know what movement they're a part of, because they're not going to get anything out of her. And the clip you played with Mumia Abu-Jamal, I just find him to be just incredibly accurate, just very valiant, intelligent, and extremely well-informed from behind bars. And I just feel that with him acquiring hepatitis C in prison, I wouldn't be surprised if they didn't do some sort of rogue medical apartheid-esque experiment on him to give him this disease in the first place. And now that they were forced by international political pressure to remove him from death row, they basically, they don't have a problem with it now, because he's assigned to death row via this hepatitis C and how long they wait to treat it. So essentially they're getting what they want, and they're going to allow the disease to do what they're now not going to have solitary confinement for 23 hours a day due to him. And it's just really disgusting. And I'm hoping, you know, I believe futilely hoping, but I'm hoping that, you know, he can be exonerated or at least given the opportunity for a proper trial, which I know is not going to happen in the system of racism, white supremacy. Thank you for taking my call, and I'll mute my line.
Sure. For sure. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, do you all have comments you want to share?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir, we can hear you. Did you have comments?
Oh, yes, I apologize. I muted myself on accident. I'm calling from Ground Zero, San from South Florida.
Did you mute yourself again? Not hearing you.
I got it now. I got it now. The mothers from the mothers with Hillary Clinton. I think it was Thursday. Scotty Reed had a program, Black Talk Radio news program, speaking about Reverend Barber and his comments about typical black elected official comments about pushing forward, just the rhetoric, the normal rhetoric, and saying how we should endorse Hillary for this reason or that reason. And I think it was Thomas from New York that said it. It's nauseating. It's to the point. It's just hearing it over and over again. We should fall in line and be behind people who we know are racist. We know are evil towards our people. Are people that are doing things steadily against, in a negative way, against our people. And, it's just, it's nauseating and it's infuriating, mainly for me, because I understand, like I said, I'm at Ground Zero, so I understand the confusion. The confusion level is so high amongst, it's called regular black people, just everyday working or not working, just right at the bottom of racism, white supremacy. And I'm saying to myself, you speak about help, we should get behind Hillary Clinton. She's somebody that's helping, but it's the same lady that passed the crime bill that another elected official was saying that he didn't know it was going to have that much of a negative cause and that he would have never voted for it. Well, you guys are in the same government, And if he made a televised statement like that, you didn't hear the statement. If you did, knowing that happened, you would still endorse this woman. So, and that's, like I said, that's the thing those things are confusing our people in my eyes, but like almost more than anything. And like I say, the mothers, my heart goes out to them. I feel their pain. I don't have any choice but to feel their pain. But I think I heard another caller saying it's just hearing them talk like that, and we should get behind Hillary. And these are the same people that have us in this mess in the first place. So just to hear that, it just made me sick to my stomach. Like, almost like somebody comes in, like, really, you see them kill your family, and then you turn around and you say to them, "I forgive you." It's that type of situation, and it's very confusing. And I envision Hillary Clinton just sitting in the back in her mind, just like a kind of evil professor, with her fingertips together, like cackling, because that's all they do. Nothing, all the policies and the laws and everything, they don't follow. They leave them to us and other people to follow them. They don't follow their own laws. We're being slayed in the streets with impunity, and we constantly hear our black officials or victims say we should forgive, and let's just be docile and hope for a change. And like I said, it's infuriating. And the thing about Michael Jordan, I just reposted a meme that I saw that said, Michael Jordan he donated, I think, $2 million. From what I know, $2 million or somewhere in that area, but he's worth $1.4 billion. So that's roughly the equivalent of you having $100 and you donating 17 cents. I can't tell him how to donate his money. don't jump in the fight, man. You didn't have anything to say before. You were Republicans were Jordans too, and now it's like I think I heard one of the callers say, no, maybe it was a commentary, the clips that said, hey, you can say something now. You know what I mean? You can say something now. White people, white supremacy is a little relaxed on it. They kind of getting money and a push off of it. So you can say something now about being an activist and being for your people, or just, you know, getting out against the things that are going wrong, but don't take it too far. And that's just how I see it. And I gotta say, it's infuriating. And I know I speak to a lot of people in my same environment around me, and they feel the same way. So I just want to make those comments. Thanks, Gus, for the platform, and I'm Yuma Lane.
For sure. Prompt about the metaphors, heard a few there, the like someone coming in and killing your family. That's a simile technically, but metaphor nonetheless, just prompting about those. I don't think Reverend Barber is an elected official. I think he's, as I said, affiliated with the NAACP, but to my knowledge, Reverend William Barber, he is not an elected official. Unless, if someone has information on that, what office he holds, you can set me straight. But I don't think he's an elected official. The other thing I did want to get in, that the statement about the shoes, just the power of racism, white supremacy, and the importance of remembering deception, primary weapon of racist man, racist woman. And all the talk about Michael Jordan this week, I read for the first time, because I had seen that comment that he allegedly made some years ago saying Republicans buy shoes as well. And I believe it might have been in the Undefeated piece. I'll have to go back and find it. But they reported this week that he never said that. And the person who allegedly originally was the one who said, oh, yeah, Michael Jordan made this comment, came out and said, oh, man, I'm so sorry that he's gotten attacked for that and pilloried for that all these years. He never said that. And people have just went for the last 20 years quoting him and saying that he made this comment that Republicans buy sneakers too. And that's the first time that I ever saw anything in writing where someone was saying, no, he didn't actually say that. So I think that is important just to get that out on the record as well. Again, Michael Jordan, victim of racism, white supremacy. Other folks that we have not heard from have comments that they want to make sure they get in.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, this is Ken Steele from Chicago. And I just wanted to touch on the Michael Jordan press release that came out this week. This is, I think, the third press release that I've seen from Nike / Jordan brand in the last, I would have to say, in the last 2 months. I believe there was first a press release about Michael Jordan's good deeds that was published in ESPN magazine and ESPN.com. And in this piece, they detailed Michael Jordan's supposed contributions that he made to the struggle against white supremacy, supposedly behind the scenes. So that was released. And then shortly after, I'm going to say about a week after, the next weekend, I noticed there was another press release from the CEO of Nike. And it was a piece that was just detailing what Nike has done to, increase the number of non-white people that work there and to give back to black communities that buy their products. And then finally, there was this most recent press release coming from Michael Jordan himself, and it capped off with his donation of $2 million to two different organizations. Now, I'm going to say I mentioned this a couple of weeks ago or maybe 3 weeks ago, but there has been a concerted effort amongst white supremacists to disseminate a number of press releases designed to make it seem like their institutions and their key figures are, in fact, pro-black, or they are not participants in the system, white supremacy. And this is just something that I've noticed increase dramatically, especially after the shootings of Philando Castillo and Alton Sterling. And this is just something that I've noticed. I suspect, with respect to Nike, what's going on is that they are noticing online that a number of non-white people are openly discussing boycotting the Jordan brand, boycotting Nike, going to different alternatives to buying and purchasing shoes. And they're really trying to get out front to the sneaker buying community and to the black community at large to create a narrative that says, hey, that Nike are part of the good guys. But I have your listeners be reminded that shortly after the shooting of Mike Brown, Nike went ahead and gave a 25% discount to all law enforcement officials who purchase products from their stores and their website. So, you know, this Nike organization has been doing the double speak towards their non-white consumer base for quite some time. And that's something that should be noted. And another thing that I would like to note is with respect to the mothers of victims of white supremacy that were present at the Democratic National Convention, man, that to me was a very, very sad and very, very tacky display. I personally called my mother, and I even made a public post on Facebook saying, hey, look, if I ever happen to find myself a victim of a race soldier, please, please, please do not find yourself hugging next to any politicians. I told my mother this personally. And I just made it known that, you know, it is against my wishes to have my memory being used to help support some politician to get to office. And then the part that bothered me the most was that there was no mention of any sort of substantive policy measures to prevent any of these deaths from occurring in the same manner that these women lost their children in. So that's something that really bothered me. There was all this talk of listening, hearing, but there was absolutely no discussion about solutions and absolutely no discussion about plans. And I think that was probably the most insulting aspect of both the Republican and Democratic national communities. Just the fact that these people were paraded and showcased, and then there was no concessions, no changes offered. And then we had to suffer through a memorial for suspected race soldiers that may have lost their lives. I'm beside myself when I think about this. And that's all I'll contribute for right now. I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Other folks that we have not heard from, did you all have commentary you wanted to get in? Folks that we have not heard from.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hello. Greetings all. And I agreed for the, I didn't even know that they were called Mothers of the Movement, but I wrote down that they were called the Club of Heartbroken Mothers. Like, that's a quote directly from their speeches. And I thought the entire thing was tacky. And I'm actually happy to hear that it made other people nauseous, because I actually had the physical response of nausea myself, and I couldn't believe what I was watching. Especially how the first mother began with, you know, like, the entire thing. And how she was saying how Sandra Bland gets to, like, speak through her mother. Who wrote this and how? I thought it was interesting. They didn't specifically mention anything like certain key words. You can tell like there were certain words that were placed within the speech that, you know, like trigger words. So police brutality was never used, but they used gun legislation or proper gun legislation. I was like, this is definitely written as a propaganda for Hillary. And the one other thing that I thought was really interesting, they used the word restoration. You can't restore something that never was. So they were saying how Hillary is going to restore something, but it never was for her to restore it. So I thought, well, that was interesting, the use of that word. And then they said, one moment, because he was playing music. Oh, and then how Hillary isn't afraid to talk about race. And in my mind, I immediately heard, unlike the weak Obama, because I was like, why is she saying Hillary's not afraid to talk about race? If you're not trying to say, well, somebody else is afraid to talk about race. And Trump obviously is not afraid to talk about race. He's not having, you know, I guess the positive conversation. So in some ways, they're alluding to how President Obama was impotent in this sphere of dealing with, you know, young black lives, and how he, you know, didn't really directly address it in the way that, oh, Hillary is promising to do and so forth. And I felt the same thing, like that, oh, she sat down and talked with us. And it was like, what? There are tons of people who sat down and talked with you, but you must, you know, not coming at them in such a way that it's like their fault. I completely understand. We're all victims of racism, white supremacy. But I was very frustrated by that. That whole, if, you know, this white person over here giving me this attention or validating me makes me feel oh so good. You know, you'll do anything. Throw your child's name out to help raise this white woman up so she can become president, which I even think is really weird too, because, you know, they have a black man be president first, and their whole rhetoric throughout that whole part, and then like a little bit of the other things that I watched, was pretty much saying how Hillary's going to do and be stronger than, you know, to do what President Obama couldn't do, and then pretty much be stronger than President Obama. So you have the black man first, and then now this like white woman coming up. And the whole thing that like really bothers me is not necessarily that it happened, because it's historical, non-white, specifically black people being used as puppets to further promote white people's agenda. But also that like we really buy into it, and that whole kind of like God, church, Jesus rhetoric. And she, even the way she began, let me tell you how good God is. I was very frustrated by that. I couldn't believe that, you know, that really was happening. And each one, I wrote down how each one mentions God, like each one of them does. And it's really funny, because then I watched a little bit of Bill Clinton's. I kind of got frustrated, so I couldn't finish it. But I watched a little bit of Bill Clinton's, and they never mentioned God. Which then, you know, you step back a little bit, and it's like we're always supposed to be these, like, soulful, moral people, while white people don't ever have to talk about that. Like, never have to really be these moral people or these religious people or anything like that. And, you know, when you get the whole picture, I guess that's just us, like, what, you know, non-white black people do. And I listened to the beginning part. He goes on and on and on about how he met her. But you can even tell from his, and I guess this might be the woman part, but you can tell by how he's talking about it. He was like, I just wanted to get her number and da 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 da. Like he doesn't meet her with the intention of marrying her right from the beginning. And you can get that tone from the way that he talks about it, which kind of, to me, alludes a little bit, not to say that that's immoral or something, you know, to be attracted to someone and not necessarily be saying you want to marry him. But it's so funny because it's such a stark contrast to how supposedly religious and God-fearing and all this other kind of stuff the mothers of the movement are, and how kind of, you know, tacky Bill Clinton is, given what we all know about him and what he did. And that's okay. You know what I mean? He still gets this 45-minute long speech pretty much saying how he was just really, really attracted to Hillary and whatever, and it took him some time, and then he fell in love with her. That whole thing, it's extremely tacky. I haven't had a chance to listen to President Obama's or Michelle Obama's, but I will, and I'm sure I'll find something that's frustrating in there too. But it's really just all propaganda. And I'm glad you played the speech by the young woman in Baltimore. I forget her name. But it was that same preachy rhetoric. Like, I guess there must be some study somewhere that shows if you inflate your voice like this and say it like this, black people just believe anything. And it's really frustrating. And it makes it so important to, like, step back a little bit and really listen to the words. Because I almost thought, I mean, not that I followed anything of what she did. I don't know anything about her, so I am not attacking her whatsoever. But I was like, are you a spoken word artist?
or like, a, you know, something else, because it's, and it was a long, the entire thing. I got nauseous during that one too. So I was like, say what you need to say and just like wrap it up. Cause it was just a little bit much, but that kind of fervor, you know, non-white black people love to get caught up in the hype. And I think that's one of our really major pitfalls is, you know, so if it rhymes or it has like a flow to it, or it's like, it sounds passionate, we might just like buy into it, and people know that and kind of use it. Along with the double speak, I'm happy someone mentioned that. And then just because
like 5 minutes, has, we could just hang tight so we can get everybody in once, and then you can have time to share what other commentary observations
okay.
you have. We'll have extra time. Thank you kindly, ma'am. Other people that we have not heard from, make sure we get everybody, and then if folks have extra commentary, we'll have time for that too. Anybody that we have not heard from, you should speak up now.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. First, just regarding the mothers of the movement, I agree with the last caller 100%. It was nauseating when I initially heard Trayvon Martin's mother give that speech. And the first impression that my mind went to was Dr. Amos Wilson. And this is a quote, because I never forgot it. I thought it was the greatest quote I heard in probably my life. He said that we must be out of our minds to live under these conditions. And he said, if you're not living in reality, you're either hallucinating, you are distorted, or you're living in a fantasy. And these women and any other black people who vote for these white people, and in general, not just Hillary and Trump, they need to leave that alone, because after five centuries, to think that they need or have a white savior, they need to let that go. They just need to let that go. And I also want to remark about Mamiya. When I initially heard him on Democracy Now! A couple of days ago, I was listening to Miss Africa when you had her on your show a few nights ago, and she was really concerned about his health and hepatitis C. So when I initially heard him on Democracy Now!, I was so glad that he sound good. He didn't sound sickly, and you know, he sound good. And I'm glad that there are people who are, you know, keeping a close eye on him while he's in prison, because I have such high aspirations for him, such high aspirations. And I truly wish him, you know, a long life, wishing well, and hopefully he will continue to, you know, educate us on racism, white supremacy. So thank you for taking my call.
For sure. Other folks that we have not heard from, other people we have not heard from.
Can I be heard?
Let's see. We'll get 4231. Is that you, 4231?
Okay. Peace to the callers, to the host, and to the platform. I just wanted to share some commentary on the whole presidential election thing and the conventions. And I think it's like what Mumia said, that is, you can't forget that it's a show. And I think that racism, white supremacy is definitely running wild at the moment, or out of control, so to say, because they survive politically, because it's like, when we don't mention racism, white supremacy for what it is, exactly, it's like they capitalize off of that. And I think also that Tupac said it the best, that even though it seems heavy set, that we were not ready to have a black president, because it's like 8 years went by and we didn't get anything accomplished. And then by the end of all of that, this is what we were left with: Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. And also, if I'm not mistaken here, on page 166 of the
ISIS papers, it says that it's absolutely critical to the white supremacy system of religious thought was the formation of the image of a white man as the son of God. The white male image then was referred to as Christ, no matter that the prophet Jesus was a black man. And so I think that historically that this is part of the reason why racism, white supremacy has the tone that it does have. Like, sometimes they act like they, you know, Christians and they down with God or whatever, but we all hear about Freemasonry and Illuminati and devil worship, and then we know about racism, white supremacy, and it's like we don't put it together. And I think that that's a big part of the show, the Freemasonry or the racism, white supremacy, Freemasonry that's going down in the background, because those people can't speak up and say anything. And so I think that that is definitely part of the problem that never gets mentioned, but it's very vital to us being successful. And the mothers, I just think about ISIS when I hear those mothers get up there and speak, because it's like, you know, here we are some odd years later after we got attacked by some terrorists, basically, and here are some of our mothers still caught up in the daze and confusion about what's going on, because we basically alleged citizens of the country, of the terrorists, that were successful in that campaign called the Crusades, which gets downplayed, and we're so concerned about jihad. That's all I have.
Retired firefighter, you were going to speak as well. You with us, sir?
Yes, yes, sir. Greetings to everyone. I would like to thank everybody who called in and spoke before me. I've been had the opportunity to listen and learn. Which is a part of constructive counter-racist codification, is to always attempt to learn. It seems like the two most popular things to comment on this week is the non-white black females who were presented as mothers at the convention. I don't have any focus on victims of racism. They said what they said, VGQ. My focus is on racism, white supremacy, and the white people who made the choice to practice racism, white supremacy. They are at fault. I can call names, but it will take up most of Mr. Renegade's program, who are immediately responsible for what is making everybody want to throw up. But I would specifically say the person who is most going to benefit from that incorrectness is Mrs. Hillary Clinton, who, from a teaching standpoint, is teaching us how shrewd and sophisticated and refined a white person can be into practicing racism and white supremacy in plain sight, right in front of your face. So that should be a motivating factor for us to continue to move forward into studying and learning the system of racism, white supremacy, what it is and how it works, and in turn developing as best as we can on a daily basis, counter-racist codification, thought, speech, and action. The other popular subject that is being commented on, and I'm trying to have to remember it now, is the what's the other popular thing that took place this week that people are talking about on the program right now? Somebody help me out because I just flipped my mind. Oh yes, Michael Jordan's donation. Michael Jordan, once again, victim of racism, white supremacy, VGQ. If Michael Jordan gave all of the money that racist white man and woman allowed him to attire, to obtain, we would still be on a global system of racist white supremacy.
So
I am 59 years old. Michael Jordan is younger than I am. I guarantee you that the global system of racist white supremacy existed long before him or I were even thought of. The focus is on the global system of racist white supremacy and the white people who make the choice to practice it. That's all I have. Thank you.
Right on. Other folks who dialed in that we have not heard from, feel free.
May I be heard?
Your volume is very low.
Okay, is that better?
Look, if you could speak up louder, lots of black self-respect to give us as much volume as possible.
Okay, I hope that's much better this time.
That's an improvement.
Okay, thank you. It's a lady in New York. So just listening to the medical research and how there's supposed to be some type of uniform consent, or there's a desire to have uniform consent. I know for certain that an opt out for that will not just be made readily available. Just with what I go through now currently, if you have to go to like an urgent care, or if you go to the actual hospital, to the emergency room, and you are, you know, asked, do you want to make this information available electronically on some kind of system? You really cannot opt out. They'll send like 3-4 people in, and all you're trying to do is get medical care to say, no, you can't opt out. We need this for this reason. And you'll say, no, I only want this information available to my primary care doctor. It's really not an option. So whenever this plan is implemented, there will not be an opt-out option, no real opt-out option. And it really makes me feel nasty just thinking about what they are doing with blood samples, body parts, teeth, who knows what they're using and experimenting on over and over again. One of the reasons why I did not want to have any of my kids in a hospital, but unfortunately did, because I'm like, what are they doing? What are they doing with things that are left from after, you know, having a child? And I don't know. I don't know how they're using those things. I know it's probably not to my benefit or my children's. The domestic violence issue, non-white women are never going to be protected in the system. No one has a vested interest or really cares. So there are going to be incidents where things happen to these women or these places that are supposed to be safe havens kick them out. It's something I've seen repeatedly. Although white women, when they do have these situations, from things that I've seen, are housed as far away as possible and given many accommodations. We had actually a few women in my area who were allowed to start businesses and sent to school. for as far as the women who unfortunately had their children murdered by racist white supremacists, I just feel so sad for them because they are being subjected to a lot of mental and spiritual manipulation by white people at this point. And white women participate in that just as much with the manipulation and the abuse. They are not black women's friends. The only thing we share in common is that we are women. They are not parenting their children with the same goals that we are parenting our children with. They don't have, and their children do not have, the same concerns that black women and our families do. And they're just not your friend. They don't have any vested interest in you, and that's just how I feel about that. As far as the political prisoner, just continually hearing the recording, stating that he was being monitored. I wonder how much that fosters non-constructive communication between prisoners and their family members or other people, especially with the rate that these prisoners have to pay or their family members have to pay for the calls and constant interruption. I don't know how he was able to stay focused with that. I think that was all I had to say. I'll mute my line.
Right on. Any of the folks that we have not heard from at all, if you had commentary, you should speak now. I did think it was highly significant that we had Ramona Africa of the MOVE organization in Philadelphia on Tuesday, and then Mumia called into Democracy Now! The following day on Wednesday, hours apart. We had just talked about Mumia. Anyone that we have not heard from at all, you should speak now. Yes, ma'am. Let's get caller in Ohio. Let's get our caller in Ohio.
Okay. Real quick. Hello, Gus, to you and to all the callers on the line. I hope, like the young lady said before, that everybody is doing okay on the plantation wherever you all are at. Just a couple of things. The story about the young lady at the restaurant and the waitress, and when I read the story the other day, and I said, wow, that is a good example of two-faced racism. Now, of course, I didn't get a chance to read that book, and I heard about it on your show. This is one of your shows in the archives. And, you know, like what's said in front, you know, according to the article I read, the waitress was real nice at the table, you know. And then, like, you know, the girl was on Snapchat, and she, you know, sees this article where she sees the young lady's comments, you know, about, you know, how she's hungover and she's got to wait on all these niggers, you know. And unfortunately, though, I do think the black girl's like, well, you know, I forgive her. So, like, that's good. Like, you know, she did get into a fire, which I thought was good, you know, but, you know, just to love her attitude. Like, well, I forgive her and all this, that. But I just thought, I said, well, that is a very good example of two-faced racism, how people can smile up in your face and, you know, treat you, you know, and then go walk right away from you behind your back and, you know, say the things that it, that they will say. And I even think on one of your shows this past week, you said something about white people because of the black people. It will always be some kind of racist comment or either, you know, referring to us as animals or something like that. And I just think, you know, black people, we have got to realize that these people, if you want to call them that, are just true to themselves. And we have to stop the blindness that we seem to have, you know, for them with that. And I always say, to me, one of our biggest problems is always looking for these good white people. And you know, and I think about when you said one time Dr. Canvon said, you know, no one's saying that they're not good white people, but the numbers are just so small, you know, they can't help you. You know, they wouldn't be able to help us. And I just think that is a very big part of our problem, just looking for these good white people. I didn't really watch either of the conventions, but, you know, I heard about the thing, you know, Mothers of the Movement, and even before the convention, when I first heard about this, you know, you just knew it was just exploitation, and, you know, these black women are being used to help garner this vote for Hillary, And I remember, I think at one time when the primaries and stuff first started, you know, the thing was, oh, you know, the black vote is going to be her firewall or whatever, whatever that means. And I just kind of think that the setup now is, and it has always been, but that the setup now is, if she loses, you know, then, you know, I don't care. You will read it. If black people had just gotten them off their flanks, you know, gotten them off their behinds and went to the polls and voted, you know, she should have won. So, I mean, she wouldn't have won. So I'm just thinking that's part of the setup, you know, as to what being done. The piece about the Butler School District and the hair, and I remember last year school time, either early this year or, you know, last year with school, and, you know, we were hearing sporadic cases like this. And I remember I wrote on my first page, my Facebook page, and I said, you know, you have school districts around the country that are basically writing dress codes for black kids and black children and black children only. And this one was probably the most explicit. I think any of us would be able to say that, you know, I've heard her sing, but I thought it was rather telling. She basically said, oh, well, that code has always been there, you know, and I'm just like, but I guess this is the year that you're going to finally enforce it. And so, you know, I can applaud the mother, you know, who, like, you know, her child goes there, and, you know, your hair is, well, you know, your hair is there, and basically what the school district is basically saying is that black girls, you know, want to go to school here, you're going to have to perm your hair. That's basically what they were saying. So I just thought it was just an interesting thing. And my last comment is, and I just thank you for the piece with Mamia, the young man is in prison, I'm afraid I can't pronounce his name. And I remember I used to see your show with Ramona Africa this past week, and she talked about him. And I remember when I heard about him, you know, being sick. And we know, I mean, you know what the prison system is doing. They're just slowly letting him die. And even tonight, where it was talking about with the esophagus would be bleeding, the liver would be gone. And there was something about, even then, they were going to put him on another list, or they would put that person on another list. You know, and I guess that's just a list. Well, just waiting until the guy, because the esophagus was bleeding and the liver's gone. Basically, you know, you're talking about maybe hours that, you know, somebody's going to be dead. So I just, glad to know, to me, he sounds really good, you know. But I just want to say thank you, too, for having that clip on. And thanks for allowing me to share my comments. And I'll mute myself.
Right on. There was the other female caller who spoke up simultaneously with our listener in Ohio.
Yes, it's Kama. Good evening, Gus, and good evening to all the callers. And the comments are really, really good. And I have to say that since my goal a couple of years ago was kind of to take over the Democratic Party here, and then I'm going to start trying to take over the Republican Party, and then they won't have a party. So, the thing is it looked so black because they had a very strict formula. The formula was, like, in Texas, it was like, okay, we need 3 gay people, we need 2 men, a black woman, and if we can have a couple of mixed people, that would be good. Okay, you guys, you've already got 3 mixed people. We're just going to have to go with a gay person. We're going to get that from Brazos County. And that's how it was. Even if you wanted to go, even if you wanted to run, even if you had the money, if you weren't, if they needed 3 more gay people, then you couldn't go. And that's why the convention looked like it did, because the Democratic Party said exactly what they wanted it to look like, and they picked the people down to skin tone. The next thing was, I recently spoke to the school board, and I don't think this is a metaphor. I told them that I did not appreciate them pimping our children, and I do feel like that was what was done to the children of those mothers of the movement. They use those children's bodies and names without their permission for their own personal gain. And I do think that they pimped those those people's children. I do. I really do. And another thing, I think that in their families, I don't think the children love them as much. I don't think they love their mothers like we love our mothers. I don't think that their husbands revere their wives like, you know, families revere the mothers here. I just don't think so. And I didn't even see any love when Hillary's daughter spoke on her behalf. I saw, oh, she's my hero. I have admiration for her. But there was no love there. There was no love there. And that's why when you see those commercials, I guess, with Secretary Clinton, she's around all of those black children. She is loving that. She gets more love from those children than she has probably ever gotten in her life. And I think that they still think that they own our children. They think our black children are wasted on our black families and that they should have our black children. And they love having our black children as pets. And they love how our children make them feel. And I think that they just are addicted to that. What is it? Oh, yes. I appreciate what Chief Prosecutor Mosby said in the Freddie Gray case. I thought she was very brave and true. Maybe she didn't do herself a lot of good, but it was good to hear how that is, because I'm dealing with that myself down here. And I always remember that Dr. Welsing said anybody who went to school as long as that cartoon character, whatever she said, anybody who's ever had any kind of training, nursing, nurse's aide, or whatever, knew that Mr. Gray's spine was broken before they put him in that police van. It was absolutely clear. And I remember Dr. Welsing said it, and I saw it myself, and I certainly saw that. So, one of the callers was talking about, you know, now they have the black president, so now they're going to have the white president. But we learned this in our readings, because it was exactly the same thing. White women always capitalize off of a black movement forward. Frederick Douglass was with the abolitionist movement. It was co-opted by that suffragette movement. And the same thing with the civil rights movement. It was co-opted by the women's lib movement. I mean, the same thing now with President Obama, boom, all of a sudden it's like white women are going to break the highest glass ceiling. They always, always come in and prematurely stop our forward momentum, and all of a sudden it's always about the white women. The last thing I want to give you an update on is Sandra Bland. Should I wait? And Ms. Bland was starting to get like I said, the police officers are starting to come forward, and we're finding out that he was prevented from speaking to the grand jury. He said, I wrote my report, and I told the DA that I was listening as Brian Insignia gave his, was talking to his superior on the phone, and he told him, and I heard it clearly, he said, no, I don't know what I'm going to charge her with yet. So he clearly made up everything. He clearly, the just the lionest group of people in the world, he clearly made up everything. And then when he got his report back, when he wrote all of that down, the DA had falsified his report. Right there, those are two felony counts. So we're going to proceed forward with that. And also, if you go on the internet, you'll see that there's a one-year secondary investigation on all of the lies that we have turned up on Ms. Bland's death. So that is there because the sheriff has got to go. He's got to go. I mean, he's got to go. So I was like, how am I supposed to stay here these days? So he's got to go. I got to keep at it. All right. That's it. Thank you for listening.
Right on. Is there anyone that we missed? Anyone who had a hand up that we have not heard from at all?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, thank you, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners, and callers. I wanted to touch on a few things, especially with the significance of I'm hearing about when it comes to Miss Hillary Clinton, I guess, you know, being a woman, and I think that's cold for white women. and all of these stories coming up with white female waitresses practicing racism one towards another female, you know, like somebody should really just say, you know, stop this right now. You know, we're talking about this being for all women. You know, we just had a black female actress called the animal on social media, and there was another white waitress for Texas Roadhouse saying that if she could do a purge, she would kill as many Mexicans in one night. And, you know, basically being inspired by that movie franchise, you know, just that the violence they have on the brain. So I'm thinking they're not being inclusive of all women, basically. And when it comes to forgiveness, that's usually pushed when we are the victims of white supremacy. And when it comes to that waitress who was fired, I think that was the Cheddar's restaurant. Like, was that an act of forgiveness? Because it didn't seem like they didn't say, oh, well, you know, I forgive you and, you know, you can keep working. You know, they terminated her immediately, my understanding. And there was another white woman that unfortunately has, I guess they call it the so-called transracial adoption with the two black kids. I think her name is Rachel, I think Garlinghouse or something like that. And she said that her and her husband's, they have an acquaintance. That's how she said it. They have an acquaintance that referred to their 2-year-old black son as a cute little thug. And she was saying that her white privilege, so-called white privilege, was starting to diminish because of that. But it hadn't gone anywhere. It's not really that. It's the power aspect. So she's basically just seeing how they're being mistreated, but that's not really affecting her. So, you know, just to make a connection on that, and I'll give it to the next person. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Did we miss anybody? Anybody who dialed in that we have not heard from at all? All right. I'll assume we hit everybody who had a hand up. I know the female caller previously had said she had a few more comments. She wanted to make sure that she got in. Anybody else, if you have extra comments, we have about 14 minutes before the end of the program. I did want to say, Marilyn Mosby, the state prosecutor in the Freddie Gray case, black female, she has been under a gag order for a year, so I think that contributed to her talking. She spoke, I think, for about 12 minutes. I think that was a contributing factor to the tone that she took, in addition to her frustration about what has taken place. But she's been under a gag order and not allowed to speak for about a year, I think more than a year, since the Freddie Gray killing back in 2015 in Baltimore, Maryland. That was one. The second thing, since there did seem like quite a bit of time, and I have seen not just with this call, but throughout the week, people voicing their displeasure with Michael Jordan. That was one of the more popular items of the week, and even to a degree some of the commentary about the mothers at the Democratic National Convention. One of the things that I do encourage, resisting the urge to criticize other victims of racism. I think some of the callers did make a specific point of saying that. One thing that I will say, it's been my experience, victims of racism tend to be much more enthusiastic at fault finding amongst other victims of racism when the person that you know the most flaws, the most faults about would be yourself. So in my view, any enthusiastic fault finding should begin at home. And I generally don't hear people come out and volunteer and talk about errors that they have made with regard to racism, white supremacy, when they didn't have a clear understanding, or I wish I had done this, wish I had done that, wish I had not done this, wish I had not said that. It is very easy to sit back and point out what we think of as flaws amongst other victims of racism, as opposed to just stopping and looking at the things that I just did today, this Saturday, July 30th. What errors did I make today? And let me share that with other folks. These are the silly things that I did today, and I'm going to try to not do again tomorrow. These are the times when I did not stand up courageously to racism, white supremacy. That is something that I do think should be pointed out regularly. Resist the urge to criticize other victims of racism. Anybody else have other comments that they want to make sure that they got in?
Can I be here?
Your volume is very low. Again, if you could speak up, give us as much volume.
Okay. Is that better?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. I think I have to place the phone the correct way. I just wanted to make a brief comment about just the forgiveness of white people, and I know other people have made a comment on that, but I honestly can't recall ever having heard a white person tell me that they loved me, forgave me. Seldom have heard them say that they were sorry to me. So, again, very interesting to hear victims freely say that and give that to white people. I wish that other victims gave that type of love and unconditional forgiveness to me, and I hope that I can give that to other victims as well. But I really can't recall a white person ever extending those words to me. So it just came up in my mind. I will mute my line.
Other folks have any other comments they wanted to make sure they got in? Any additional commentary?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I wanted to include, following the Mothers of the Movement presentation this week, it was released in the WikiLeaks that members of the Democratic National Committee were exchanging emails making fun of the names of black DNC members and donors. So I just, you know, want to put that out there. Be on the lookout for that article. It's going to be proliferating for the rest of the week. Oh, and also, I just wanted to mention, with Facebook banning more and more profiles, they are also ramping up their checks to see which profiles are legitimate or not. And if you have a profile that does not match your state-issued ID, they will target you and they will ask you to either change your name or they will just delete your profile. I personally have found ways around this and methods around this. So if you are finding yourself facing some sort of timer or countdown for the removal of your account, feel free to reach out to me. I'm Ken Steele on Facebook. I'm in Chicago. I'm also on Facebook, Ken Steezy. I'm officially verified as Ken Steezy on Facebook, so I've got around their checks on that. I can show you how very easily. And, so that's just what I can lend to help other victims of white supremacy that may find themselves the target of censors on Facebook. That's all.
Good to know. I did think it was important as well. One of the shorter segments, it was a white woman in Colorado where she did testing for the state and prosecutions, and she made her comments about her contempt for black people, and she got fired. I thought that was significant as well. Not only last year, they had the big report about how the FBI, they had been given all this inaccurate official data that, you know, was overwhelmingly in support of prosecutors and putting people in greater confinement who might have been totally innocent, where they said, oh, yeah, we got all our highfalutin scientific data and hair analysis and everything, and it turns out that the stuff was bogus. And it was a lot of cases that they were talking about. Just it reminded me of that. And another instance where you have a white person who is in a very powerful position where they can come in, be an expert and testify in court, and looks like racist white supremacist doing the job. And particularly if we're talking about law and how you end up with so many black people in greater confinement, this is how. Just not to be taken lightly when they have these little cases that come up where somebody posted something on social media, or this white person went on social media and called this black person a nigger or whatever, that it is not something that should be trivialized, or, oh, that's just an ignorant white person and that's not that big a deal. No, not at all. This helps explain why things are the way that they are, why things look the way that they do when you have racists, not just that are the ones that are giving you whatever food you're going to put in your mouth, but these are the people that are making decisions about who ends up in greater confinement, who's testifying in court, the judge that's on the stand adjudicating the case, so on and so forth. I did think that was pretty significant this week as well. In addition to the reporter who was making the jokes about Michael Brown being on a lead diet when he heard that his mother was going to be at the DNC. He got transferred, not fired. Other folks have commentary they wanted to get in, last 5 minutes or so.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes. I just wanted to clear up. I wasn't nauseated at the mother's. I was nauseated at the fact that they were being showcased, and maybe I should have been more specific, but they're being showcased to push the Democratic agenda to, you know, limit guns and come up with gun control. But the reason why they're being showcased, one is they're black, but the other is because other than Trayvon Martin, all the other people were killed by cops. One of them was choked to death. He wasn't even shot. So the legislation they're being showcased to push has nothing to do with what was actually happening to us. This is a police killing black people problem. And they're making this into this has something to do with, you know, the shooting at the nightclub or the shooting at the movie theater or Sandy Hook. This has nothing to do with that at all. I just wanted to say that. And I'll meet my mom.
Just for the record, Hedalia Pendleton and Jordan Davis, neither of those black people, one black male, one black female, neither of them were killed by enforcement officers. Their mothers were also present at the convention.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I like to piggyback off of what Thomas said. I definitely agree. Maybe I didn't articulate myself as eloquently as I should have either. It wasn't anything I was trying to direct at them personally. It was more or less like he was saying, it's the fact that they were being showcased, and then the confusion for other non-white people that can be generated when you have black people that are being showcased in the way in which they're propagating literally the person who is partially and probably mostly responsible for what's happened to their children, essentially. And she's like an intergenerational killer and incarcerator, as far as I'm concerned. So that's really what I was nauseated by more than anything else. It wasn't the females themselves. They're victims of white supremacy, so I would never judge them on any level for anything that they do. You know, they're doing the best that they can, and they're probably, you know, just confused and still obviously dealing with grief. And, of course, just the whole idea that her entire platform and campaign has been a campaign of white validation, to me is just a sad evidence of the fact that that particular form of white supremacy works very well, and it works well to confuse massive amounts of black people to literally back someone who is probably the most deadly candidate to black people that I've ever seen. Thank you, and I'll mute my line.
I don't want. Other folks have comments they want to make sure that we get in last few minutes before we conclude.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, really quick about Michael Jordan. I was just thinking about that story a couple of years ago with Scottie Pippen, because I know the two of them were linked from the Chicago Bulls, and he had that incident where he was holding his, I think, his two-year-old daughter, and I believe he didn't sign an autograph, or he was trying to hurry up and leave a restaurant, and a suspected racist had spat on him, had spit on him or whatnot, and called him a nigger. I think that's how it accurately happened. So I just wanted to exemplify that story to say how, even though he has a lot of wealth and he's obtained a lot, they pretty much think of him the same way generally. And that's all I have.
And if I could add on to Michael Jordan as well, Jordan is a victim. And I said it on the show before, Jordan made $100 million from Nike last year, but they sell the sneakers and clothes with his logo on it, and they made over $3 billion. So his cut was pretty minimal, if you ask me. So he's definitely a worker. He's very limited in what he can do. Even though it looks like he owns things, he doesn't really own them. He's like the front guy.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
You know, I've made mention of this fact in a situation where I was in greater confinement, and I will tell you that that is one of the most heartbreaking truths that you can give to certain victims of white supremacy. So please be careful with whom you share that information with.
We pretty much did our 3 hours. I was reminded, with all the attention on Michael Jordan this week, number one, I was reminded of Bill Cosby, that regardless of how much resources racists allow any victim of white supremacy to have, they can take it back immediately if they choose. And I think they have demonstrated that repeatedly over the years. I don't think Michael Jordan is any different in that regard. But I was also reminded of the biography that came out not that long ago on Michael Jordan. It's titled Michael Jordan, written by a white person, where they talk about racism, white supremacy pretty explicitly. And he talks about Michael Jordan, who grew up in North Carolina around the time when they were having what's called the sit-ins in North Carolina, and SNCC was doing their activities, and Robert F. Williams, North Carolina legend, that was happening right during the formative years when Michael Jordan was growing up, in addition to all the Klan activity and what have you. And Scotty Reeds, founder of the Black Talk Radio Network, his North Carolina. But in that bio, I'm just going to give two quick paragraphs from that book. I suspect Michael Jordan has, I'm sure he doesn't know lots about racism, white supremacy. I do not either, but I suspect he knows quite a bit in that book. It reads, "The deep sadness the whole family felt after Michael Jordan's grandfather passed perhaps enforced Michael's newly discovered racial anger. He didn't know every detail of his grandfather's life, but he only had to look at the pain deep in the old man's face to get an idea of how troubled his restless journey had been and of the many senseless barriers he had been forced to endure. Later that year, a girl at school called Michael a nigger. I threw a soda at her," he recalled. "It was a very tough year. I was really rebelling. I considered myself a racist at that time. Basically, I was against all white people." Obviously, that changed at some point, looking at his current wife. But I do think that is a rather interesting anecdote among many, because white supremacy is a pretty major theme in this bio, if folks are interested in checking it out. Again, it's titled Michael Jordan, written by Roland Lansby. I think this came out in like 2013, maybe 2014. Anywho, that will do it for this broadcast. We should be here. Number one, we'll be here on Wednesday. We will finally do our one broadcast dedicated to the Purge franchise, all three films. The Return of Dr. Martin Kevorkian, admitted white supremacist, also author of Color Monitors, which is a pretty informative book He gave out some great guest suggestions throughout the year as well. But he should be here Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, normal broadcast time. We'll be looking forward to having him on to discuss all three films, including the latest Purge film. I think one of the callers mentioned the incident we talked about earlier this week where another white racist server went on social media and said that she wanted to purge Mexicans, non-white people, because they were poor tippers. I talked about the incident, the white terrorist in Indiana who killed three people. He's facing the death penalty, and he wrote that he was going out purging and was inspired by these films. I think the white supremacy coding in them, it's pretty explicit, the timing of when the films have come out, the amount of money that they made. It is a fascinating study. Looking forward to that this coming Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Once again, Dr. Martin Kevorkian returns to the cows. It looks like I will be setting things up with Sue Africa. Ramona Africa spoke about her on the program earlier in the week, and Sue Africa did say that she was willing to come be a guest on the broadcast. So I'm definitely looking forward to having her ASAP come in to visit and give her perspective on what she experienced as one of the few white members of MOVE. Even just this week since I spoke with Ramona Africa, I was doing additional research, and it looks like she was not the only white person who belonged to the MOVE organization in Pennsylvania, but we'll be looking forward to that. Just stay tuned. We'll have a time, date, all that good stuff once we get everything official with Sue Africa. If you have questions, complaints, guest suggestions, gripes, feel free to drop an email untiljustice@gmail.com, untiljustice@gmail.com. Listener-supported, counter-racist radio. PayPal button is in the top right corner of the blog, the address racism-notes.blogspot.com, racism-notes.blogspot.com. Again, PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you are not into PayPal, drop us an email. We will get you a physical mailing address. Huge thanks to all the folks who have invested 7+ years. I hope the program has provided some constructive information on what white supremacy racism is, how it works. You can get us on Twitter as well, at Until Justice. We're on Facebook. Should not be that difficult to find if you have questions or need information trying to find something in the archives. I will recommend strongly, again, I know it's summertime, folks are out having a good time, great. You do not want to be lax in your codification. Certainly, I still strongly encourage sobriety. That would be best under conditions of white supremacy, being under the influence, particularly if you are in an automobile. You are making the job of race soldiers way easy. You never know when it's going to be Daniel Holtzclaw, Darren Wilson, Daniel Pantaleo. That is the one that is pulling you over to rape, pillage, end your life. We want to be able to make phenomenal decisions each and every time. We're in an automobile, really, in any area of people activity at any time. Being intoxicated is going to hamper that effort tremendously. Buckle up every time you're in a vehicle. Let's do everything that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers. With that, thanks for everyone tuning in. I hope it was a constructive investment of your Saturday evening. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, no brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Shut I'm a up. Victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.